The Pentagon just cranked Israel's counterintelligence threat level all the way up to critical, the highest designation, right there with our worst adversaries. U.S. officials are now using burner phones and staying tight-lipped in hotel rooms when they visit Israel because the Israelis are aggressively spying on top Trump administration people, digging for inside dope on decisions about Iran and Lebanon. This isn't some rogue operation. It's all coordinated, hyper-aggressive espionage from our so-called closest ally. Jonathan Pollard-style damage from the past should have been a warning, but here we are again. Americans are rightly asking how an ally that spies on us at this level gets treated like family.
With me, I don't care if you start throwing nukes immediately, responsibly, but immediately. And a case that I've been pushing is the use of an electromagnetic pulse weapon or weapons against Iran. Why are we waiting to get hit?
That's Jonathan Pollard, the most famous Israeli spy in modern history, who sold out our secrets, got our agents killed, you name it. He sold to the Russians, the Chinese, the Israelis, everybody. And remember, Trump pardoned him back at the end of his first administration. So now Israel's funding will be within the Pentagon in joint weapons development, but they're going to be allowed into everything and be able to claim co-ownership of the U.S. military-industrial complex that Eisenhower told us to beware, the technological elite that control the military-industrial complex. So think about that. Then you've got 38 states that have passed laws or executive orders that if you criticize Israel anyway, or ever boycott Israel, or criticize Zionism, or what happened in Gaza, these are laws that you cannot have any government contracts or government jobs. Totally illegal, unconstitutional tyranny. And that's because Israel admits they're moving their weapons industries here to the United States. And so now, if you criticize anything Israel's doing, you're shut down by the state governments, violating our First Amendment. You add that with the NDAA, National Defense Authorization Act, you got to read that for yourself. Total lifetime fusion integration of everything, from academia to DARPA to MIT to secret weapons development to live intelligence, telemetry, weapons guidance, weapons systems, everything. Remember, the other agencies don't even let each other know what they're doing. The other armed services branches are in competition and let them have their secrets. And that's good to keep things compartmentalized. This is, Congress doesn't even know 10% of what the Pentagon's up to. This is Israel's coup against America.
The real gut punch is what's happening in Congress at the exact same time. On the heels of the revelation of Section 224 slowly advancing, Senator Tom Cotton slipped Section 622 into the FY27 Intelligence Authorization Act. This thing locks America into permanent, unbreakable intelligence entanglement with Israel. It mandates expanded sharing, ties it to Israel's qualitative military edge, restricts the president or future Congress from scaling it back without jumping through huge legal hoops and notifying bought and paid for committees, and even pushes sharing with Abraham Accords countries. There will be no unwinding this. We are looking at intel fusion as a pillar of policy, handing over leverage that could bite us hard if relations sour. We'll find ourselves either towing the line for Israel or facing serious consequences. Meanwhile, the Pentagon flags Israel as a top spy threat, and lawmakers are wiring them deeper into our system. This isn't partnership. It's a one-way street that smells like foreign influence money run amok. America first means putting our sovereignty and secrets ahead of any foreign lobby. It's not optional, and it's a major insult on this 250th anniversary of our nation. John Bound reporting for the Alex Jones Network at alexjoneslive.com.
All right, folks, this is the War Room. War Room Live. Find us at alexjoneslive.com, on Rumble as well, rumble.com/thewarroomlive. We'll be right back in about 90 seconds to hit the ground running with all of today's headlines. We've got updates in the Carmelo Anthony trial and Israel spying to talk about. Don't go anywhere, folks. Big show. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to War Room Live. I'm your host, Harrison Smith, coming to you live this Monday afternoon, the 8th of June, 2026. Thank you so much for being here with us. We got a lot of news to cover today. Of course, updates to the Carmelo Anthony trial. It's not looking good. It's actually looking extremely bad. You just got an update from Brianna Morello, but just the bird's eye view overview of all of this is basically the defense called some witnesses. They completely backtracked and admitted that they didn't actually see what they claimed to have seen. Basically, the entire foundation of the defense in the first place collapsed. And now there's a lot of speculation that they're possibly looking for a plea deal, which I don't understand. I don't think that's possible. Is it? Is that possible? That you can get a plea deal after your defense rests? Because that seems like an oversight. That seems like a loophole that should be closed. You're telling me that you can refuse a plea deal, reject a plea deal, go through the entire process of a trial, lose, essentially, understand that you've lost, and then go, yeah, actually, now I think I want a plea deal. Actually, now that I've lost, I think I deserve a plea deal. Crazy. Crazy. The crew's looking it up right now. Yes, it is legally possible to get and accept a plea deal after the defense rests, but it's incredibly rare. A plea agreement can technically be negotiated at any point before the jury returns a verdict or the judge issues a ruling. I think that's cheating. I think that should be considered cheating. That doesn't make any sense. I mean, the whole reason why we have plea deals is to avoid the trial, right? I don't even like plea deals as a concept all that much. But I do understand that, like, if you've got somebody dead to rights and they know it and you know it and you're like, look, we don't have to spend the money. We don't have to spend the time. I mean, it takes a lot of time. They got 600 people together and sifted through them to come up with the 18 jurors, the 12 jurors and the six alternates. That takes a lot. That's a lot of manpower. That's a lot of time. That's a lot of effort. So you avoid all of that by going, look, we've got you. You know, we've got you. We'll go easy on you if we just skip the whole hullabaloo of the trial. You admit it. We go our separate ways. To go through an entire trial and then accept a plea deal, I don't get how that is even possible. That seems like cheating to me. We'll bring any updates as they arrive. I believe the defense has rested, but they're still closing arguments to do tomorrow. So we won't be getting a verdict by any means, but the report is that police presence around the courthouse has increased since they're expecting anger when the appropriate and accurate verdict finally comes down. So again, we'll bring you the updates on that. I still think it's very, very funny that the entire claim of Carmelo Anthony, not even his like innocence, but like the only way he could possibly be declared anything other than a cold-blooded murderer was this claim by the defense that that he was surrounded and he was ganged up on and he was in fear for his life. And there was never any evidence for that. There was a lot of evidence to the contrary. Is this the actual exchange witness? He was getting defensive. We didn't, someone we didn't know was in the tent. Carmelo said, you'll have to move me. Austin put his hand on his back. I saw Carmelo's hand go in the backpack. We were at a track meet. I wouldn't have expected to be there. But essentially, the defense witness claimed at the time to police that he saw all these guys gang up on Carmelo Anthony and that he thought it was self-defense because they were surrounding him and he couldn't get away. Then they play the video that not only shows that A, didn't happen, but the B, the defense witness had his back turned to the event the entire time, so he could not have seen what he claimed to have seen, which, as a lawyer, as a prosecutor, I mean, that's got to be a beautiful moment. The dopamine rush I'm sure they experienced when that was exposed. Because you can try to impeach a witness a lot of different ways. Very rarely do you get an absolute contradiction, video evidence blowing up not only the central claim that they're making, but by extension, everything else that they're claiming, because they've been proven to the jury and everybody else to be abject liars. So, amazing, amazing stuff by the prosecutors, amazing failure by the defense. As Brianna Morello was speculating, and I think there's something to that, you know, maybe they think they'll do better if there wasn't so much media attention. Maybe they just let this case fail by making some obvious mistakes that they can't get in trouble for but that would require a retrial, and then maybe a year or two from now, the heat's died down, and you can go through it again. But again, what a ridiculous scam all of this is. What a ridiculous scam all of this. I mean, every day this trial goes on is really like another crime being committed by Carmelo Anthony and his supporters and his family. He did it. We know he did it. He did it, I've been saying since the beginning, likely because he wanted to do it. He went there with that intention in mind, wanted to provoke a fight, wanted to stab somebody. That's been my assumption since the day it happened. And he could have just said, I did it, you got me, taken a plea deal, and put all of this to rest. Instead, they are maximizing racial conflict in this country. They are causing yet another instance of division through all of this. They are just lying completely. They collected all this money for a lawyer, and then, as my understanding is, they didn't even hire a lawyer with the money, and now are going with a public defender. Like, maybe that's why the defense has been such a pitiful failure. But, like, they know all of this. They know all of this. He knows that he stabbed the kid. He knows that he's guilty. But, like, on the off chance that they can weasel their way out of it, he'll put all of us through all of this, and all of his supporters will support it when... You can just imagine a world with at least moderately decent people that even if something goes crazy, they don't then feel the need to put everybody else through all of this horror all over again. I mean, to have these kids that I guarantee to this day probably get nightmares about what they experienced. I mean, I know a girl. I mean, it's just, you know, just think about what happened. Think about what happened here. If you've ever known anybody that, like, was the person to discover a murder victim, it's like that doesn't go away. That screws your entire life up forever. Imagine being one of these kids getting ready to do a day of track when, like, your team leader is just disemboweled in front of you. I mean, these kids are not. But Carmelo Anthony is going to make them go sit in front of a crowd, go sit in front of the eyes of, you know, a very contentious public, and relive that day in detail, in specificity. Why? Not because he thinks he's going to get away from it. He knows he's guilty. Maybe it's just hatred. Maybe just has a perverse love of seeing people suffer. I don't know what it is. I also don't know why we put up with it. So anyway, we'll bring you any updates as we get them. But long story short, the defense utterly failed to provide a single exculpatory piece of evidence, even the witnesses. And the claims that that formed the foundational basis of the entire defense argument were shown to be complete liars whose testimony was worthless. So can we charge them for that? I don't know what we do, but, like, how do we let the next Carmelo Anthony know that we're not going to put up with this? I don't know. Maybe we do just have to put up with it. I think there are easier ways. I'm not sure if I'm allowed to say them on the radio. Like I said, we'll bring any updates and clips we find on that. I don't necessarily want to spend a whole bunch of time on it because it's just so obvious, but it is worth exploring the deliberate way that racial relations are being destroyed in this country. But we've got an anniversary to celebrate, folks. Well, wait, not celebrate. Condemn and memorialize is actually the correct word, because it was on this day in... What year was the USS Liberty? So I'd say 56, but that's a different name, a different date I was thinking. 1967, the USS Liberty was targeted deliberately for eradication by Israel in either a false flag attack to try to get us into the war against Egypt or to simply destroy our ability to monitor what the Israelis were doing, because they may have been... Brace yourself. This is a shocking. They may have been committing war crimes. I know what you're thinking is that Israeli history began on October 7th, 2023. You may be surprised to know that there is almost a century of war crimes leading up to that moment. So people don't know that. They think that Israel didn't exist before October 7th and that was its creation. But no, in fact, it had been around for a while, actually. And nothing has changed. And nothing has changed between October 7th and now and all the way back in 1967. In other words, the behavior of the Israelis has been a consistent plague on American foreign policy. And our soldiers and our governance this entire time. I'm going to go to the speech by Thomas Massie. It's about 5 minutes long, his speech on the floor of the Congress, which I love that Thomas Massie got ousted by Israel and was like, all right, I still got a few months in office. I'm going to make the most out of it. And is like writing bills to ban the ADL and AIPAC and is memorializing the USS Liberty and has now put forward a bill to stop Section 224. So I want to see him, you know, burn as much as he can on his way out. In this case, this is not something born from dislike of Israel, really, even. It's born from, well, to memorialize it, to commemorate it. You don't need an excuse. Why wouldn't you, right? These are your soldiers that were attacked and killed by a foreign power. It's actually very normal to remember that on a regular basis, commemorate that, memorialize it. That's totally normal. It's not born from some hatred of Israel, but not necessarily. Maybe it can contribute to that. The thing is, nobody can argue against the USS Liberty claim. They used to try. They used to try to lie about it. And in fact, what I should have done is grab video of the first Groyper War. If you remember, the first question of the first Groyper War, which was Nick Fuentes sort of culture jamming the culture war tour that Charlie Kirk was doing. And the first question asked was about, I believe it was the first one, was about the USS Liberty. And how can we say that Israel is our greatest ally when they did this to us? And Charlie Kirk's response was the standard response at the time, which was to say that's a conspiracy theory, that's anti-Semitic, how dare you bring that up? Ben Shapiro has, you know, confronted this question by basically saying, man, it was a long time ago, it was a mistake, who cares? That doesn't work anymore. You can't run with that anymore. It shows you how much things have changed since, I think, 2019, if I'm not mistaken, was the first Groyper War. So 2019, people like Charlie Kirk, major figures in the, you know, conservative right-wing movement, still had this knee-jerk reaction to claim that the USS Liberty didn't exist and wasn't real, and it was a total conspiracy theory, and shut up, you anti-Semite. Now we have libertarian congressmen giving five-minute speeches about it on the floor of the Congress. Things have changed quite a bit. But it's not just about memorializing it, which is normal and everybody should do, and it's not just motivated by hatred of Israel. It is about understanding how long Israel has controlled America, how thoroughly they control America, what the American government is willing to allow them to get away with, or in the case of the USS Liberty, actually participate in, right? This wasn't possible without, you know, direct involvement by Lyndon Baines Johnson and others in the U.S. military. And then the cover-up after that. I saw a lot of people asking, why would we care? Like, why do people talk about this? Is this really going to stop the war in Iran or whatever else? And it's just, I don't believe that you can make that statement if you're not motivated purely by sort of a Zionist impulse to silence the truth. It doesn't make any sense. Why would you talk about one victim of a serial killer? I don't know, because they were a victim of a serial killer. Because taken together, all of these examples paint the picture of who we're dealing with here. Knowing that not only was this never punished, right? They paid no price for this. The men that died or were horribly injured by Israel never got the justice they deserve. But that it was covered up deliberately by the mainstream media and political actors for the last 50 years. The same people who will claim to be, you know, the patriotic Americans like Mark Levin, as he, you know, encourages us to go to war with Iran, hate the survivors of the USS Liberty. They hate them. They really despise them. You really have to ask yourself, is this not a regular occurrence? Do we not see this throughout history? Because I've seen it. I've seen it on Twitter. I've seen it all over the place. They call people like Phil Torney and other survivors. They call them anti-Semites. They call them Nazis. What did he do wrong? What was his crime? To be a victim of Israel. To be a victim of Israel. To be a target of theirs. If you don't submit, you're the bad one. You're a Nazi now. Because you won't quietly accept that they're allowed to kill you. It really is despicable, but it's interesting framing. It's kind of like how you'll see Jewish film directors making documentaries demonizing Tsar Nicholas. And it's like, what did he do wrong? Oh, he was killed by the Bolsheviks? That's his crime? You'll see this cropping up over and over again, where it's like some of the people that are claimed to be the biggest anti-Semites, you go and you look at why they're called that, and it's like, wait, they were literally just victims of Israeli aggression and didn't accept that and weren't okay with that, and therefore have been called anti-Semites and Nazis. And the USS Liberty survivors are maybe the best example. Directly targeted. They tried to kill them. USS Liberty sailors survived and then were shunned and ignored by the wider American public basically for the rest of their lives until a couple years ago. And of course, except for people like Alex Jones making a documentary about this all the way back in the 90s. Let's go now to Thomas Massie on the floor of the USS the USS Congress, the US Congress making the speech about the attack of the USS Liberty. Let's watch.
On the next day, on June 8th, they started the day. The visibility was unlimited. The American flag was flying proudly on the USS Liberty. More planes came from Israel to surveil the boat, the ship. And they thought they were in good shape. But what happened next surprised them all. French Mirage jets showed up and for 25 minutes strafed and attacked the USS Liberty. They shot rockets. They shot 30 millimeter cannons into the hull and into the ship. They even dropped napalm on the bridge of the ship. This was an effort to kill everybody on board. There was no intention of taking prisoners. After the 25 grueling minutes of attack on this virtually unarmed ship, and they thought things were over and they could recover, the torpedo boats showed up, three torpedo boats. They launched four torpedoes. One of them hit the hull of the USS Liberty and killed 25 people instantly. It blew a 40-foot by 40-foot hole in the side of this ship. They were intent on sinking it. But they were also intent on not having a single survivor. According to eyewitness accounts, the Israelis machine gunned the lifeboats that they put down. They machine gunned the firefighters who were on the deck. They were bringing the wounded and the dead to the mess hall to triage them. They had one doctor who was trying to help them all, put a few stitches in. It was harrowing, and it's amazing. If not for that crew, that boat would have sunk that day. But it still wasn't over. Helicopters showed up, combat helicopters. And the USS Liberty, even though their signals were being jammed by the Israelis, got a signal out. And there were ships that tried to respond. The USS Saratoga, the USS America sent planes. Both of them sent planes to help the USS Liberty. And something happened that's never happened before. A ship under attack, the planes were recalled. This has never happened before. And they sat there for 17 hours. 34 dead, 174 wounded, out of 294 crew members. That's over 70% casualty rate, unheard of. The Israelis were intent on leaving no survivor. And what about our own military? Why did they not send anybody for 17 hours to help these men? So what really happened? You know, the official reports say that it was a case of mistaken identity. But if you listen to Dean Rusk, former Secretary of State, Richard Helms, CIA Director, Bobby Ray Inman, head of the NSA, Captain Ward Boston, who was the chief counsel of the Court of Inquiry, if you listen to Admiral Moore, who served in Pearl Harbor, Midway, commanded both the Atlantic and Pacific Fleet, and was chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. None of these distinguished men think this was an accident. They think it was intentional murder by the country of Israel, either as a false flag operation or because they simply didn't want anybody observing what they were doing that day. Well, I've got a call to action for everybody here. Honor these individuals. Quit ignoring that they exist. Go to their website, ussliberty.org. Support them. And while they're still alive, they need closure. Let's give them closure. Let's have an investigation. Let's pass a resolution honoring them. It's long overdue. And then they can have their justice. With that, I yield back. And I ask unanimous consent to enter into the record a declaration of Ward Boston declaring that the only official court of inquiry was invalid.
59-year USS Liberty anniversary remembering Israel's deadly attack on the American Navy spy ship. And again, like Thomas Massey said, it could have been a false flag attack. It could have simply been that they didn't want the USS Liberty monitoring them, as it was the most sophisticated, you know, monitoring ship out there. The response to this from the Israeli firsters, and they're really getting exposed these days. And it's very interesting because obviously we were called panickins, we were called leftists and Hamas supporters for not approving 100% or not going along with Donald Trump's attack on Iran. And we were told basically you're not really MAGA. Donald Trump is MAGA and you follow him blindly like a sheep. Don't you understand? But now he's going against Netanyahu. And little rat-faced weasels like Mark Levin are very angry about this. That's kind of surprising. Don't you understand, Mark Levin? We're on Hezbollah's side now. Don't be a panickin. Don't be a leftist. What are you, AOC? Don't you understand? Trump is the leader. Trump is our Führer, and what he says goes. And he now says, Israel, a friendship with Israel over. Hezbollah, now best friend. So now, Mark Levin, you need to honor and support Hezbollah or else you're not a real MAGA supporter. Don't you want to follow the rules you laid down, you absolute moron, hypocrite, liar? Because that's really what it's all about. These people don't actually believe anything and everything they say is changeable. But what it reveals, obviously, is loyalty to Israel over anything else and a willingness to take advantage of and manipulate your political beliefs, the MAGA agenda, Americans' patriotism, whatever it takes to support their actual homeland, their actual loyalty, the Jewish state of Israel. So we'll return to that on the other side. Big Israel spying story coming out from the Pentagon. Alex has talked a lot about it. We'll give you the history of Israeli spying on the U.S. It's innumerable. It's impossible to say all of it. There's so much. If I told you that a congressman was getting up to give a speech on the floor of the Congress in which he would be recounting and commemorating a vicious sneak attack that killed dozens of American servicemen, wounded hundreds more, and that he was going to go and talk about these men and honor their sacrifice and tell the story about what they went through in their pursuit of, you know, serving the American people in the armed forces. Would it surprise you to learn that there was a large contingent of the conservative right wing online who were infuriated by this, who were pissed off by this, who didn't want them to do this? This is why, I mean, there's stuff like this these days where if you strip it of its timely context, the reaction makes no sense. Like how I keep saying that with globalists in charge, everybody seems insane. Wouldn't it seem insane if the most libertarian, the most, you know, classical in the classic sense, Thomas Jefferson style right wing congressperson in the government goes and gives a 4-minute long speech honoring the sacrifices of American Navy men who lost their lives 50 years ago? And suddenly the right-wing conservative influencer sphere is foaming at the mouth and furious at him for it. It wouldn't make any sense normally. Then I tell you, no, the attack was done by Israel. No, the attack on the American service ship, it was actually Israel that did it. Oh, now it all clicks together. It doesn't make any sense otherwise. It wouldn't make any sense if it was any other group of people, any other nation. It would be crazy. And it is. It is still crazy, but it's the piece of the puzzle that makes it all make sense, right? It's like the code word that unlocks the cryptogram. Why would right-wingers, why would conservative, patriotic Americans be against Thomas Massie talking about USS servicemen being attacked? Oh, because they're on the side of Israel. Okay, it makes sense now. I think I'm getting it. I think I'm understanding. And this really does sort of run the gamut across everything that we're going to cover today, including things like the CBS News takeover. There's a big interview with the New York Times, Scott Pelley. I think his last name's Pelley. I think his first name's Scott. He's been at CBS News for 37 years, and he resigns in protest against Barry Weiss. And I can't help but notice that in the entire interview that he did, Scott Pelley speaks, CBS News is on fire, and Barry Weiss should be removed. I didn't see a single example of him talking about Israel, which is interesting, because that's what all of this is about. So I guess my question is, like, what game is he playing? Is he really this mad about what's being done to CBS News? Does he really feel as though CBS News is being destroyed from the inside by these dishonest and subversive actors? Then why doesn't he call them out? Why is he happy to deflect from where the criticism should actually be going and instead want to turn it towards Donald Trump and his administration? And by extension, all conservatives, all Republicans, as if it's for our benefit that CBS News was taken over and is, you know, censoring their people. It's not for American conservatives. Nothing about the CBS coverage has become more conservative in the traditional American sense, because Barry Weiss, the person who got it from David Ellison, son of Larry Ellison, is not a conservative in any sense of the word. Kind of like Alan Dershowitz. Dershowitz also is considered now a Republican. Why? Because he is pro-Israel. Why is Barry Weiss considered a Republican? Pro-Israel. So a pro-Israeli leftist gets in charge of CBS News, censors CBS News for the benefit of Israel, and the people who are affected by it, the people who actually lose their jobs or feel like they have to resign out of protest because of this, they don't turn around and go, Barry Weiss is doing this for Israel. It's censorship on behalf of Zionists that this is taking place. They're happy to deflect that criticism towards Donald Trump and all conservatives, despite they themselves knowing that that's not where it accurately belongs. So what game are they playing here? It doesn't make any sense to me. You're going to resign in protest over something, but then not actually protest that thing. You're going to disguise the real motivation behind the people that you're protesting in order to gain domestic political points. This is all absurd. But this is where we're at. Like, this is the problem that we're in. Is it's like, on one hand, Israel is overreaching and it's doing things like blatantly manipulating CBS's coverage and forcing them not to cover things and to cover certain other things and et cetera, which makes it obvious that there's influence going on. So the people in CBS News get angry about that and want to call it out. At the same time, the power of the Israeli lobby and the Jewish diaspora in America, especially in the media, is such that they can't actually be honest about it because they know that the punishment will still come. And if they ever want a career into the future, then they better not say what's actually going on. So it's kind of interesting. So it's like, on one hand, you know, they don't have so much power that they can just force silence through this. On the other hand, they still retain enough power, and that the power that they retain is so much more than the benefit that people would get for being honest about it, that people will still keep their mouth shut. Or maybe it's psychological programming of some sort. It's like the guy that we talked about a couple weeks ago who wrote this long essay on X describing the way in which he, as a young Jewish boy, went to a Jewish camp and was psychologically tortured by the Zionists there to traumatize him into accepting, you know, Israel's security as the top priority of everyone everywhere. In case you didn't catch that show, it's pretty simple. What did they call it? They called it experiential learning. Experiential learning. They would take little kids in elementary school who were at a Jewish sleepover camp. They would wake them up in the middle of the night, drag them all to a, you know, chow hall or something, and then announce to them that nuclear weapons had destroyed Israel and everybody was dead. And the kids, of course, would freak out and start crying. Many of them had family in Israel, and they thought they'd just been told that all of their aunts and uncles were dead. And then after a few minutes of horror and trauma, they say, oh, no, actually, that didn't happen. We were just joking. We were kidding. Everyone in Israel is fine, but that could happen. But that's what we're trying to avoid. So that fear and hatred and sinking feeling you just felt, remember that. Hold on to that, right? Deliberate trauma-based mind control. This guy writes this whole thing about how evil this was to do. about how messed up it made him and how he like couldn't believe that this was a regularly practiced thing, that nobody even talks about it. And then people, you know, say back, yeah, that's a messed up thing, you know, for Jews to do to their kids. And he came back going, well, you know, it's understandable why they would do it. I mean, they were just trying to, you know, help us understand the threat that it was. And it's like, what is going on here? What is going on? Here, you're the one that wrote an essay about how it was traumatizing. You're the one that explained what an abusive practice this is, but you're still defending the people that did it. What is the Jewish version of Stockholm Syndrome? Because it's obviously more powerful than whatever the Swedes are up to, right? What is this? It doesn't make any sense. Like, do you understand what I'm saying? With Scott Pelley, it doesn't make any sense. It'd be like if Joe Kent resigned in protest of, you know, Israel's involvement in getting us into the war in Iran, but then he wrote a resignation letter talking about illegal immigration or something. And it's like, well, how can something be so compelling to you, such a motive to you, that you're willing to like blow up a storied career? Scott Pelley, 37 years at CBS News. He was willing to sacrifice all of that. That's just how strongly he felt. He just doesn't feel quite strongly enough to tell the truth about it. What are you talking about? It's not like he doesn't know. Maybe the propaganda has really worked and they genuinely think that now like support of Israel is the one and only discriminating factor as to whether or not you're a conservative. Because if Barry Weiss is a conservative, then that's what it means. If Alan Dolshowitz is a conservative, then it means support of Israel and nothing else, because these people believe in gay marriage. I think Barry Weiss is married to a woman, if I'm not mistaken. So you have a like lesbian progressive diehard ultra Zionist, and anything she does gets blamed on conservatives. Conservatives take the heat. Conservatives get blamed. Those conservatives, they don't believe in free speech. Look at how Barry Weiss is interrupting CBS News. Pro-trans, pro-gay marriage, pro-reparations, pro-everything that we're against. But she supports Israel. Therefore, everything she does is actually the American Republican Party's fault. Unbelievable. And so the connection to that, of course, to the USS Liberty is sort of that same idea. Why would you try to cover this up? Why would you not tell the truth about this? What would be your motivation for concealing the reality about the USS Liberty or trying to downplay it? And again, notice the way that the coverage of the USS Liberty has morphed. It has changed. Really, we should do a compilation of this. Somebody could make a compilation of this and it would really be amazing, is how people respond to USS Liberty over the years. Get Charlie Kirk saying, it's totally fake, it's conspiracy theory. Well, that's not true. It, of course, is real. And that is a very offensive thing to say to people who lived through it, who experienced the attack, to then turn around and tell them, you're just an anti-Semite. What a horrible thing to say to people. That's not the best way to approach this. So then they reconfigured, they collaborated, they got behind the scenes, and they said, oh, okay, it did happen, it is real, it was Israel, and denying that just makes us look bad, so let's just say it was a long time ago. This is a long time ago. The only reason you want to bring this up must be because of anti-Semitism. It's a sort of a different form of the same argument when they say, if you criticize Israel for their lobbying efforts, but you don't criticize Timbuktu for theirs, you're motivated by, you know, you have to be equally upset about all of these things. Otherwise, your true complaints are not valid. You're not allowed to, you know, be mad at Israel murdering their neighbors if you also don't condemn Qatar spending a fraction of the amount to build universities here. Okay, great. Good point. No, it's a great point. That's really smart. Can't believe I hadn't thought about that. So that's sort of, it's like, wow, this thing that happened a really long time ago, you're still talking about that? Of course, the obvious answer is the Holocaust, but we would never. So it changes. So it goes from this didn't happen to, okay, it did happen, but you're not allowed to talk about it, to, okay, it did happen and it was Israel, to, but it was a long time ago, so you bringing it up is actually the bad thing. It's all ridiculous. It's all absurd. And it becomes a litmus test for people on the right wing. Do you care about the USS Liberty? If not, you're an Israeli agent. It's as simple as that. It really is. There's no other reason to not care. I also think it's funny to see left-wingers pretend to care about this as if they wouldn't turn around and call the very same soldiers foot soldiers of the imperialist and et cetera, et cetera. They never seem to be able to justify their hatred of Israel and their hatred of America, considering the fact that my dislike of Israel is motivated by their behavior against America. Anyway, we definitely don't need to get into that right now. But Jeremy Boring of whatever that old company was used to be called. What was it? Daily Wire? But then he moved on. But now he's doing something else because he drove Daily Wire into the ground, if I'm not mistaken. I think he had fantasies of being a Hollywood director and ruined the whole thing, if I'm not. Guys, can I get a check on that? He left right before the decline. No, I think it was him. No, I'm going to blame him. I'm actually fairly sure it was him. He had this idea of like the Pendragon cycle where he wanted to basically go toe-to-toe with Hollywood. But he made a fatal flaw. He made one major mistake in that he didn't hire me, Harrison Smith, the greatest filmmaker of all time. I've never been given a chance. Would I work for Jeremy Boring? No, he could work for me. We'd have to make some changes. So here's what he said. He says, 59 years ago today, an American Navy vessel, the USS Liberty, was attacked by air and sea by the State of Israel. Here we notice the first major change in the way that this has been talked about, right? Again, up until just a couple years ago, remind you again, when Groypers brought up the USS Liberty to Charlie Kirk in 2019, he immediately shut it down and said, do not talk about that. That is a conspiracy theory, and I will not stand for that type of stuff in my event. That had been the standard response for the last 50 years. Something has changed. Now they feel the need. Now, they're not doing this because they actually are concerned about the USS Liberty. They were forced to admit this because it's true and because they look ridiculous denying it. But this is the first part of the major change is they actually start off by saying, look, everybody knows the USS Liberty was attacked on purpose by Israel. We know that. That's established. As if that's not the major point of contention that they were trying to cover up for the last several decades. Now, they adopt the truth. They admit the truth and want to act like, yeah, everybody knows this and it's unimportant. Well, if it was unimportant, then you wouldn't have spent the last 50 years trying to cover it up and lying about it. Huh. That makes sense, right? I think logically, that's a fairly sound argument I just made. 59 years ago today, he says, an American Navy vessel, the USS Liberty, was attacked by air and sea by the State of Israel. Of the 234 men in the ships, 34 Americans were killed. 71 were wounded. Today, Thomas Massie will take to the House floor to memorialize the worst interpretation of this event. What, the one you just laid out in the first two? Wait, I'm sorry. What could be a good interpretation of this event? Oh, no, yeah, they totally murdered 34 Americans, but, it wasn't a bad thing. Yeah, okay, so they snuck attack their allies, the defenseless Americans who thought they were their friends, and murdered almost three dozen of them. But, what, are you going to make that sound bad? You're going to portray that like it's an unfriendly thing? Thomas Massie's going to get up there and condemn it? How dare he? How dare he not understand the truth about the matter? The truth. This might be a good place to sort of explore the Israeli conception of the truth, because it's one of the common things that I kept seeing crop up over and over again when I was making the Eighth Front War, is that they are very concerned about the truth, but they have an entirely different definition for that word than you and I might. See, to them, showing footage of Palestinian children and women and old men being bombed and decapitated and having their limbs torn off, that's not true, okay? Seeing that footage, the actual, tangible proof that it happened, that's not true. The truth that they need everybody to understand is that Palestine is evil and that they're all terrorists and that killing them is what you have to do, or else they're going to kill you. So, like, yeah, okay. So the video is real and what it does show is real, but the truth is only if that video is enshrouded by all of the propaganda in Hasbara that makes the bombing and the killing okay and good. Do you understand? Okay. So the truth about the USS Liberty is that it was a vicious attack by our quote unquote greatest ally, killed dozens of young American men, and then it was covered up by the collaborators in the American media and the American government because Israel has been taken over by America has been taken over by Israel for the last several decades. But let's continue. So he says the worst interpretation of the event, an interpretation that suggests Israel attacked the American ship on purpose and our own government either coordinated with them to do or complicit in the cover up. Okay. Yes. So once again, the accurate and verifiable, timeline of events. True. Thank you. The USS Liberty has become a rallying cry for many of the worst voices in public life, from the Groyper Wars against Charlie Kirk to Candace Owens' Black Pill and Despair political project to Candace Owens' global jihad of grift and Jew hatred. So I haven't seen anything about the USS Liberty like discrediting that claim yet. So what we have here, if we break down his response, it is to admit that Israel destroyed the USS Liberty, admit that it killed sailors, to condemn Thomas Massie for claiming that it was on purpose, but not to provide any evidence that it wasn't on purpose, but to instead completely divert into a diatribe condemning, again, for the 10,000th time, Tucker Carlson, Candace Owens, and anybody else that isn't a slavering slave of the Jewish state of Israel. Nothing about the USS Liberty. Obviously, right? The conspiracy theories surrounding the USS Liberty have become one of the most respectable ways to advance anti-Israel and anti-American sentiment. Well, okay. Does Jeremy Boring not understand the way anything works? Like, that's not complicated. Providing proof of the bad things they do is actually a perfectly reasonable way to argue that somebody's a bad person. Like, what? What are you talking about? It's like, this is typical. Of course you're going to present the evidence that my client is a murderer. You're trying to make him look like a murderer. Okay, but he is. So what? What are we talking about? Presenting the evidence of the horrors and betrayal of Israel, that makes you an anti-Semite because talking about Israel doing bad things, well, it's just like I always say. Hate speech is when reality matches the stereotype. Let me say that again. Hate speech, anti-Semitism, racism is when reality matches the stereotype. Okay? So the stereotype would be that Israel doesn't actually care about America, is not our actual ally, will betray us, will attack and kill our people to false flag America into a wider war in which a much more significant number of men get killed in pursuit of Israeli interest and not American ones, that the mainstream media knows this and goes along with it and conceals facts about Israel's behavior and antagonism towards America to their American audience to keep the grift going. See, there's all of these stereotypes about the Israeli control of America that are confirmed by the USS Liberty. Therefore, talking about the USS Liberty is anti-Semitic. It's hate speech. You're not allowed to talk about it. It confirms too many stereotypes. It comports too exactly to what the most vicious anti-Semites would make up if they didn't have plenty of real things to point to. That's not a good argument, though. That's not that's actually the argument of a psychopath killer. That's why I keep talking about this in terms of like a serial killer and presenting evidence, that sort of thing. You see this over and over. If you watch true crime, if you watch interrogation videos or anything like that, you'll see people who, even though they're like caught dead to rights, they see the accusation of them as further evidence of their, being persecuted. And they even the way they phrase it, it'll be like, they'll be like, we think that you murdered this person. They'll go, you have no reason to believe that. How dare you? See, you don't know that I did it. So you accusing me of doing it is just evidence that you hate me and you're persecuting me and you had it out for me from the beginning. Remember the person I'm talking is a murderer. They actually did do it, but that doesn't matter to them. That doesn't matter to them because you're saying it without to them the sufficient proof to make that claim. Then it must be motivated by, bigotry, even though it is in fact true. everybody has to go insane for any of this stuff to make any sense. Everybody has to either be like a total psychopath, totally divorced, totally uninterested in what the truth is, and merely in manipulating perception to arrive at a preconceived end. That's like the only thing that's possible at this point, because Jeremy Boring knows the facts about USS Liberty. He knows it doesn't look good for Israel. And so all he's doing is desperately trying to stop people from expressing that, to stop people from talking about it, to further conceal the truth about this, or at least muddy it so that people who would otherwise possibly have their eyes opened by the history of our relationship with Israel will instead reject it outright and not actually listen to any of the claims that are made. I hope you're not falling for that. How can we know what's true, and what does it mean for us six decades later? Conspiracy theorists love to overwhelm you with the sheer volume of their claims, but there are eight claims which make up the core of the argument. We thoroughly address those eight in this episode and shine a light on the phenomena that undergird the conspiracy theories in the first place. Well, it's not a conspiracy theory. It is literally confirmed. What does he think conspiracy theory even means? The only thing that you can speculate about at this point when it comes to USS Liberty is sort of the ultimate motivation. Whether this was a false flag to get us into war with Egypt, or whether this was just an attack by Israel to destroy an American ship that would be listening to us so they could carry out war crimes without the eyes of the media and the American government on them. But everything else is confirmed. There's nothing else speculative about this. There is no conspiracy theory. There is a conspiracy. There were people working in secret, collaborating together in an international way to bring about this conclusion, to kill dozens of American sailors. But Jeremy Boring doesn't want you talking about that because he's a traitor to this country. We got a lot of domestic news to talk about, but a lot of the Israel news is domestic news. I want to go to video number one here. This actually... Happy and surprised to see myself in this video from our debate with boomers. But that's not the reason I want to play it. I want to play it because of what comes after, and I'll try to read along and try to keep up. The latest is that basically the Pentagon... So basically, Congress and the Senate got word from Bibi Netanyahu. He said, I want you to graft Israel and America and our military together. I want to fuse them into one being, and I'm giving this to you, our most powerful goy. And they dutifully took the bills, put them for a vote. Now, again, if you want to rename a library, or maybe a better example, if you desperately need repairs of infrastructure like an airport or a highway, you're going to see that the government moves very slowly. And to get anything done, to get any money, it is a real gauntlet, right? It's a real pain in the ass. If Israel wants something, you often don't even hear about it until it's already passing. It takes about a week. We've seen this in things like selling TikTok, where previously, because it was owned by China and they were feeding crap into our children's head, Trump tried to, get the energy together to force China to sell TikTok. No takers. It went on for months. Nobody wanted to do anything with it. But then Israel wanted to buy TikTok, and within 2 weeks, they had it. It was done. Problem solved. So this is another example of this. So Bibi Netanyahu calls up he rings him on the Shabbos phone, and he says, I need you to fuse the American and Israeli military. They say, yes, sir. Within a week, it's already out of the committee and going to the floor for a vote. They're hoping to get this under the wire. Luckily, somebody noticed, started talking about it, and somebody at the Pentagon then released a report showing that Israel is probably the biggest threat to our sovereignty the world over. This is not new. This is a very, very old situation. Let's go now to clip number one, and we'll just look at a few examples over the recent past. Let's watch.
Unreasoned about the concerns we have about Israel.
Well, I think it is.
What is it?
Because I think what I'm reading is you believe the Israelis are actually hostile to our country.
Yes.
And are trying to do harm to it.
Pentagon raised threat of Israel spying to highest level. Israel flagged as top spy threat to U.S. in new Snowden document. Israel, current espionage against U.S. unrivaled and unseemly. Covert economic espionage against strategic ally. Israel caught spying on America again. Trump's commander fires blunt warning as Israel spies on U.S. forces at secretive Gaza camp. Israel won't stop spying on the U.S. That's from 2014. Israel has been caught spying on the U.S. again. Israel reportedly surveilled, recorded American CMCC bases. IDF denies absurd claim. Israel accused of spying on U.S. forces monitoring Gaza ceasefire. Israeli surveillance targets U.S. and allies at joint base planning. Qatar, Saudi Arabia arrest Israeli intel spies. Pegasus spyware used to hack U.S. diplomats working abroad. Department hacked by Israeli company with spyware. Ex-U.S. envoy to Israel David Friedman tapped ahead and battled spyware firm NSO Group. Israeli spyware used to spy on U.S. officials. New NSA document highlights Israel's espionage in the U.S. Israel something prominent spies revealed the former Israeli spies working top jobs at Google, Facebook, and elsewhere. Revealed Israeli spies are writing Americans' news. How Israeli spy veterans are shaping U.S. big tech. The former Israeli spies overseeing government cybersecurity. Revelations of Israeli spyware abuse raises fears of possible use by Trump. U.S.-Israel spy strains emerge over Iran. Ex-spy Jonathan Pollard, U.S. Mike Huckabee have a meeting. White House unaware the U.S. ambassador to Israel met a convicted spy. Conservative media hosts concerns over U.S. diplomats meeting with ex-Israel spy. Epstein trained as Israeli spy, FBI document says. Israeli spying is not new, but the Trump administration's response is how to make sense of the accusations that Israel spies on the U.S. Yes, they're really asked. John Spear refused an Israeli spy. Oh, Lord. That was a very, very small sampling over just the last decade. This stuff goes back 100 years, folks. It's way worse than you just heard. We'll get into it. Stay with us. Second, saying the obvious that, yeah, Israel is our enemy. Do you not understand this yet? Do you not get this? Like, how many times do you have to be screwed over by somebody before you just accept? Like, this is one of those things where it's like, do you need somebody to tell you? Do you need Israel to literally say, like, to chant death to America? Is that the only way you can understand an enemy? Is if they say to your face that they are trying to destroy you? Because they're not going to do that. They're not going to do that. They're going to destroy you quiet. That's actually the opposite of what they're going to do. I don't know how you can come to any other conclusion than that Israel is literally our enemy and must be destroyed. That compilation, which was a smattering, a selection of, you know, spy stories about Israel and America starting around 2014, you know, up till the present day. That was, I think, by Hippie Resident at Hippie Resident on X. I believe that's the it's at least the name that was on the end of the video. But, like, again, that's like a, this is like a very, I mean, it's a lot, right? Don't get me wrong. That was a lot. But when you actually have studied this stuff for a long time, there are endless examples, because most of the examples aren't even really fully known or fleshed out. Like, what'll happen is, and it's interesting. Sometimes it'll be between Jewish groups. Like, there was a story, I think in the 80s, where it was like the Simon Wiesenthal Center and the ADL were at war with each other. And yeah, there it is. U.S. intelligence, 30 years of reports. Israel is the number one spy against America. But the whole thing ended with, you know, a lawsuit or a trial of some sort that basically proved that, I believe it was the ADL, was working with the Israeli government to spy on American citizens. And then they're giving that information to the ADL to, you know, try to win this PR war against the Simon Wiesenthal Center, if I'm not mistaken. But this would be another example of just like, yes, Israel does spy on the American government officially. You can listen to any interview with John Kiriakou where he talks about the aggressiveness with which Israel is constantly trying to infiltrate every aspect of the American government. And they have. I mean, we know that the you know, bills passed about the what do they say? Not the consecrating, but they adopt basically the IHRA definition of anti-Semitism, which conflates all criticism of Israel with criticism of Jewish people. And then in the laws where they pass accepting this definition of anti-Semitism, they also provide for offices to be established in every single branch of the federal government. So like the Department of Education has an anti-Semitism monitor who it's their full-time job to oversee the entire, you know, branch of the government to make sure that everything that's coming out of that doesn't just not offend Jews, but like actively pushes their agenda and actively supports their foreign state. That already exists. That already exists in everywhere of the federal government, I guess, except for the military. But it does kind of exist for the military. The IDF, Mossad, has offices in the Pentagon. And a lot of people that are working for our military-industrial complex are just straight-up Israeli agents, even if they're technically American, even if they don't even have, you know, dual citizenship, they're still working for Israel. So what we saw, while it was a sizable collection of examples of Israel spying on Americans, it's like just the barely scratching the surface. And by the way, this is just, let's talk about the spying. Let's talk about the spying. We'll move on from the USS Liberty. I think we've, as an organization, we've talked about that quite a bit. Let's begin with, this is a little rundown of the story from Ryan Rosbiani. Pentagon flags Israel as critical spy threat to America. The Defense Intelligence Agency just raised its counterintelligence threat level for Israel to its highest tier, citing aggressive efforts to surveil top U.S. officials. Yes, Israel is spying on the Trump administration. The target is the Trump administration's internal deliberations on Iran. A 7-page DIA assessment names specific incidents and warns Israel's human espionage and technical collection now sits at a critical level. The embassy in Washington calls it completely false. The Pentagon's own spy catchers disagree. America's closest ally in the region is now being watched like an adversary. Kind of. They should be. Whether that will actually happen or not depends on the personal loyalty of the people who are trusted with carrying this out. Gen X Girl at Gen X Girl 1994, of course, has been doing incredible work on this. She's probably one of the best accounts to follow, hands down, on X. She says Israeli lobby bot lawmakers are facilitating a whole-of-government takeover by Israel. Get the full picture so you understand what's happening. So let's go ahead and go to clip number two here. This was created by Gen X Girl, and this is just the latest battlefield, the latest full-frontal attack from the Israeli forces in this information war. Let's watch clip two now. I'll read along. So Tom Cotton is the one that suggests this. He got over $1 million from AIPAC. U.S.-Israeli intelligence sharing expansion, section 622, further embedding Israel into America's military-industrial complex. R-Res 1339, support Netanyahu's initiative to transition U.S. relationship towards defense cooperation. You have Mike Rogers and Adam Smith, both receiving nearly $1 million or $500,000. Section 244 in the NDAA is the U.S.-Israel Defense Technology Cooperation Initiative. You've got these four jokesters. H.R. 7560, S.B. 3855, U.S.-Israel Framework for Upgraded Tech Unified Research Enhanced Securities Act. H.R. 1229, S.554, the U.S.-Israel Defense Partnership Act, mandates Defense Innovation Unit Office in Israel. And then this is the sort of overall view of this, and you can see it's more or less weighted evenly on either side. Half the people pushing this are Democrats, half of them pushing it are Republicans. So again, you've got one, two, three, at least five examples of this, but some of them are sort of dual pushes, right? So let me just read this whole thing. Israeli lobby bought by lawmakers are facilitating a whole-of-government takeover by Israel. Get the full picture so you understand what's happening. A whole-of-government entrenchment of Israeli influence is advancing through coordinated legislation that subordinates U.S. intelligence, defense, and foreign policy priorities to Tel Aviv's agenda at the expense of American sovereignty, interest, and taxpayers. Section 622 of the Senate's FY 27, financial year 27, intelligence authorization, quote, enhances U.S.-Israel intelligence sharing by further embedding a foreign power into America's most sensitive national security apparatus and makes it nearly impossible to disentangle U.S. intelligence from Israel. That is sponsored by Senator Tom Cotton, one of their favorite little golems. H-Res 1339 endorses Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu's plan to shift the relationship from U.S. aid to mutual defense cooperation and joint investments, praising joint operations against Iran while pushing deeper entanglement. Don't you love that they're like the one example they have for how this has worked in the past has been the war in Iran the war that we are now 100 days into the four-day operation with no end in sight, and Israel keeps effing up for us. Yeah, great point. We should do that more. Section 224 of the FY27 NDAA establishes a U.S.-Israel Defense Technology Cooperation Initiative, tasking the Pentagon with synchronizing bilateral research, development, testing, and industrial integration across critical domains like AI, counter-drones, cyber, directed energy, and missile defense, explicitly prioritizing Israeli origin technology for integration into U.S. systems and programs of record. You know, there are lots of things to point to that would be real-world examples of why this is a suicidally bad idea for America to pursue. People point, you know, obviously to the pager attack against Hezbollah. And sure, they could potentially do something as intense as that against, you know, the American military. But, like, once this gets implemented, it's over. And Like where do you go from here, and what do you do once this gets implemented? What do you do once all of this stuff is embedded? You cannot extricate it. And by the way, all of this stuff is happening already. This is just like solidifying it. This is just confirming it outright once and for all. Explicitly prioritizing Israeli origin technology for integration into U.S. systems and programs of record. Directed energy, Jewish space lasers, I think they're called. The U.S.-Israel's Future Act, H.R. 7540-S3855, formalizes this initiative with $150 million authorized, creating frameworks for joint ventures, co-production, and rapidly fielding of Israeli tech into the U.S. military. The U.S.-Israeli Defense Partnership Act, H.R. 1229-S554, mandates a Defense Innovation Unit office in Israel cooperating counter-unmanned system programs, RTD&E, and emerging technologies like AI and robotics, and efforts to fold Israel into the U.S. national technology and industrial base alongside allies like the UK and Australia. Now, if you remember, one of the things that Lebanon John often talks about, if you ever watch Moonbase or have heard his calls here, is the fact that I believe they're the S-300 missiles that Russia was giving to Iran. And Israel really didn't want Russia to give these to Iran, because they are a very powerful missile battery that could, you know, take down Israeli jets. And so they forced Russia to include code in the operating program of the S-300 to where it would not target Israeli jets. That's the type of thing that they're opening up with this Defense Cooperation Technology Act. That's the type of thing that they do. Iran obtains a game-changing S-300 missile system from Russia. It's very, very hard to find this, but the ones they sold to Iran cannot target Israeli jets. So if you see an Israeli jet coming towards you, you tell the S-300 to take it down, it doesn't recognize it because it scans, it reads the identification code, knows it's an Israeli jet, and there's a program note in the operating system that says you're not allowed to target these jets. So that's the type of thing that Israel could do, is every weapon created by America could literally be programmed where it could never actually target Israel. When you're talking about AI being the power behind waging war into the future, how effective do you think that will be? How necessary or useful do you think that will be in the future? If you are in charge of programming the enemy's robots, you've won. Like, you don't even have to, they can't do anything. What are they going to do? It's unbelievable the vulnerabilities that we are opening up by allowing Israel to do this. Like, truly shocking. So how does it happen? So how does something like this even occur? Because you would think, and it seems like maybe even patriots at the Pentagon are under the assumption that, like, the American Congress serves the American people, and maybe they think Israel is our friend, but if they knew what the, yeah, there it is. Russian's air defense can't stop Israel from stomping on Iran in Syria with airstrikes. I'm not sure if that's the exact story, but again, that's what they, I mean, do you not believe me? I mean, what do you think Israel would do? They would just let an S-300 go to Iran so they could take down Israeli jets? Of course not. Of course not. That's the genius, right? The genius. They gave us Apollo gold pagers to destroy Hezbollah. That's the type of genius that they're now using against America. So all of these things get proposed all at once in a variety of different forms from a variety of different political persuasions and from both political parties. How does that happen? How do we get here? I probably should have grabbed the clip, but you can find it yourself if you want. The lobby, you really got to watch the whole documentary series. I think there are three episodes. There's the Lobby US and the Lobby UK. The Lobby US is three episodes long. I highly recommend absolutely everybody watch it and take notes while you do. Not just for the events that it covers in this documentary, but the methods behind the events, the strategies that are revealed by it. One of the things it reveals, and if you have a video with all three documentary series in a row, it comes in about the 56-minute mark, if I'm not mistaken. Because I was looking it up today just to remind myself, I should have grabbed the video. But it's somebody in AIPAC, and they're recorded on a phone talking to a new AIPAC recruit and explaining to them how these fundraisers work. And what they say is they are the most powerful. They say we have the most bang for your buck. Like they just know that like AIPAC is the most powerful lobby, and the politicians know that as well. And so they rent a room in a hotel in upstate or an upscale hotel somewhere in New York, and they bring the politicians. Politicians have to come to them, and they take them into a room, and sitting in front of them is like 20 to 50 Jewish people who say, we represent all Jews, we are the Jewish community, and also here's a giant pile of money for the person that answers our questions the best. So this is literally how it works. So they have a giant pile. They all contribute the maximum amount, which is like $2,000. And so if you got 50 people, it's like $100,000, right? Something like that, that they have in gift cards, in Visa gift cards. So they compile them all in a pile and they say, this is for who answers our questions the best. Remember, we represent the Jewish community, all Jews everywhere. That's us. And so then they ask the politician about themselves and they answer questions and they basically grill them and give them a little, you know, interview, audition, and whoever answers questions best, they get the support, which of course the money is a major motivating factor. But even more than that, it's the knowledge of the people in this room that you're talking to are the heads of networks and influential politicians. And yes, the money will be helpful for the campaign you're running, but even more helpful will be the good press, will be the positive support that you get. And this, of course, is said explicitly in the Lobby documentary. And so what you end up with are people from every political background taking every different position on any different topic, except they align on one thing. And in this case, with the Lobby, it was specifically the JCPOA, the Iran war, or the Iran agreement that Obama signed, limiting their nuclear, like the nuclear deal, the Iran nuclear deal. This was right after that had passed, and that was the overriding concern. And so what you're going to get is you're going to get a, you know, pro-life Catholic conservative, and you're going to get a pro-abortion, transgender, you know, progressive Democrat, but they're both going to believe very strongly, and more than they believe anything else, that Iran cannot be allowed to have a nuclear weapon and that Israel must be supported at all costs. It's actually very simple. It's alignment. It's alignment on one singular issue. And the politicians know this. And so the politicians themselves go, look, I don't really care about the Iran deal. I might even like the Iran deal. But I've got 100 different priorities I want to achieve things with. This is one of them. I can abandon that. If I can achieve my 99 other goals, I'll compromise on the one. Who cares? Well, if everybody does that, then you've got a bunch of people working on their own goals, you know, contradicting each other and working against each other. But then when it comes time to vote on something about Israel, they all are aligned. They're all on the same page. No friction. It just blows right through. That's how this works. And again, I consider it dishonest. I consider it a betrayal in many ways of democracy. There's nothing against the law about doing this. And I don't even know if I can necessarily call it immoral at the end of the day, but it's an effective strategy, and it's how you end up with people from both sides of the aisle supporting this wholeheartedly, because no matter what they believe, you have to be in support of Israel if you want support of the donor class, of the Epstein class, of the media class. You have to be on their level in this one topic, but everything else can be whatever else you want it to be. So we can't get anything done for ourselves because the overriding concern is for Israel, and the support that is shown by the Jewish lobby here in America is the thing that gives these people their power, so they have no obligation or self-serving interest to do what is best for America or best for their constituents. Their constituents can be manipulated by the people with the money, so they have to serve the people with the money. So as the Pentagon, puts out this warning going, hey, Israel is not our friends and they've been spying on us like crazy, ideally, this would be a wake-up call to the politicians that were putting this stuff forward, and they might backtrack a little bit. The thing is, they know this. They're in favor of it. They've been bought off. They're traitors. Not really all that complicated, actually. The Pentagon is increasingly concerned about Israel ramping up its spying in the U.S. recently, raising the counterintelligence level threat from America's top ally in the Middle East to the highest level, according to two U.S. officials and one former U.S. official. This, again, represents simply the latest and possibly final move of, as Gen X Girl puts it, the whole of government takeover by Israel that we've been reporting on the entire time that it's been unfolding before us, with the passing incrementally of things like first the IHRA anti-Semitism definition, and with that you get the anti-Semitism offices, and then you have the anti-Semitism czar who oversees all of it, and he of course is able to then use his official position in the U.S. government to lean on things like big tech and AI to force them to fall in line with their agenda, and they do it again with the cloaked in the power of the collective American people. But I'm telling you, I guess we'll get into it now because I've got so much to cover. Maybe I'll save it till the next round because we got a short commercial break here. And I want to go over a list of just some of the recent examples of Israel spying on America, because not only does it expose that their spying is widespread and unconfronted by the authorities and, obviously targeting people like Donald Trump and his allies, like all of that will be made, undeniably clear. But the other thing is the danger of the Israelis. Like, even the New York Times will admit that Mossad was recently caught putting tracking devices on Secret Service vehicles. What they don't tell you is that those Secret Service vehicles are the Secret Service ambulances that would transport Trump in the event of an assassination attempt or other injury. Why would you want to track the ambulance that's there to transport the president in the event of an attack? There's only one reason. It's so that you can finish the job if the first assassination fails. They want to know where he's going to be taken, where he's going to be if their first assassination attempt fails, and you want to get them at the hospital, get them en route, get them shortly after the first attack fails, as short as possible. That's what happened to General Patton. They attempted to assassinate him in a car crash. He survived, and then at the hospital was killed by one of the doctors. It's one of the things that made me suspicious early on about the Charlie Kirk assassination was that Benjamin Netanyahu was the first person to report it, meaning that he was in direct communication with somebody at the hospital where Charlie Kirk was. Just to me, sort of going, okay, so they got contacts at the hospital. So maybe if the first shot didn't work right, maybe, there would have been complications in the recovery. Could be. We don't know. So I'm going to get into, again, just a little smattering of some of the most direct attacks against American secrecy and privacy by Israel. I do want to remind you to support us at thealexjonesstore.com. We have a mega sale going on right now at thealexjonesstore.com. You're getting up to 40% off some of our top-selling products, 35% off more, and 30% off the rest. So 40% off Methylene Red, Atomic Defense, Methylene Blue Tincture, and Methylene Blue Gummies, MK Ultra, and the War Cry Smelling Salts. And a lot of people, a lot of companies will give big discounts on products that don't sell very well, but in this case, our best-selling products are also the ones with the biggest discounts. So you're getting T3 iodine, you're getting methylene red, methylene blue tincture and gummies, all of it on sale, massive discounts, thealexjonesstore.com. Stay with us. Ladies and gentlemen, yes, the Pentagon has raised the threat level from Israel spying to its highest level. This is nothing new. I believe this was only released because there was this plan to fully integrate the Israeli military into the American military, which again is just the latest and sort of final step of the whole of government collaboration that has been happening incrementally for the last several years and we've been reporting on and protesting every single development. But like this problem is so much bigger because again, they're only trying to like legalize and make official what is already happening to a very large degree. And not just in the military and not just all that stuff. It's everywhere. I mean, Apple is now getting its chips from Israel, meaning Israel is going to have root level, base level, hardware level access to every phone that they make, including the politicians and everybody else. I mean, this is such a huge, monumental threat to our safety. It's really hard to even quantify. And again, it's everywhere, right? Meta has taken legal action against Israeli spy firm NSO, foiling phishing attacks. Meta said on Monday it is filing a federal, and this was it was from today, June 8th, 2026. I thought this was an older, okay, so this actually happened today. I thought this was a, something like this happened last year. I thought this was, so apparently it happened again. Okay. Israeli spy firm NSO Group, they're filing a federal order of contempt against Israeli spy firm NSO Group for violating a permanent injunction that barred it forever targeting WhatsApp and its users. The company said its WhatsApp messaging service disrupted new spear phishing tech attempts linked to NSO, an entity blacklisted by the U.S. government for engaging in activities that are contrary to the national security or foreign policy interests. These attempts were similar to previous one-click phishing campaigns aimed to trick users into clicking malicious links and directing them to external websites, Meta said in a blog post. One click is a type of cyber attack where a single click on a malicious link or attachment is sufficient to compromise a victim's device or account without requiring them to enter their credentials. Meta said WhatsApp took down test accounts and groups created by NSO on its platform. NSO did not immediately respond to a Reuters request for comment. And if you are, you know, think that the term NSO sounds familiar, it's because it is one of the entities involved in the push to, you know, bring this collaboration about. Meanwhile, this is all the way back in 2019. Israel accused of planting mysterious spy devices near the White House. Yeah, again, I was constantly shocked that people didn't make a bigger deal out of this. And I remember at the time learning about this and being like reporting on it. Nobody seemed to care. And like since then, I brought it up and people like don't believe it because it's so egregious. It's crazy. Stingray devices, in case you don't know, are basically fake cell phone towers. So when your cell phone sends out a signal searching for a cell phone tower to ping back, it'll get a signal going, oh yeah, I'm a cell phone tower. I'm open. I'm right here. And so it'll start communicating to it thinking it's a cell phone tower. It's not. It's a collection device. I mean, it'll work as a tower so that your phone doesn't, you know, it'll still connect and think that it's just going through a normal cell tower. But in fact, all traffic being passed to or from your phone is intercepted and stored by the Stingray device. The U.S. government concluded within the past 2 years that Israel was most likely behind the placement of cell phone surveillance devices that were found near the White House and other sensitive locations around Washington, according to three former U.S. officials with knowledge of the matter. But unlike most other occasions where flagrant incidents of foreign spying have been discovered on American soil, the Trump administration did not rebuke the Israeli government, and there were no consequences for Israel's behavior, one of the former officials said. The miniature surveillance devices, colloquially known as Stingrays, mimic regular cell towers to fool cell phones into giving them their locations and identity information. Formerly called International Mobile Subscriber Identity Catchers, or IMSI catchers, they can capture the contents of calls and data use. The devices were likely intended to spy on President Donald Trump, one of the former officials said, as well as his top aides and closest associates, though it's not clear whether the Israeli efforts were successful. And this, it's, you know, it's like the example that we were reading a couple weeks ago where the data center in Georgia somehow connected an industrial level hookup to the like municipal water system and nobody noticed. Like, just think about that for a second. What do you need to do if you're just like, you know, want to dig under your sidewalk or something? You got to get permits and I mean, if they bust you doing stuff you're not supposed to, especially on city property. Somehow these people have the expertise, have the connections, have the wherewithal to not only like install these things on telephone poles outside the White House, or in the case of the, you know, data center to actually go into the municipal water service, attach an industrial line that was getting something like 30,000 gallons a day, and never even get a bill for it, never even acknowledge it officially. Like, how does that happen? How do you do that? How do you install Stingray devices outside the White House, get caught doing it, and nothing happens? Think about the levels of complicity that needs to occur here. Somebody in our government is helping them do this. Somebody else is covering it up. They're everywhere. And this was one of the stories that went a long way in convincing me that Trump was not their guy. Because I remember this in the first administration. I would use this approval and go, I don't think Trump is their guy. Why would they install Stingray devices? Why would they install tracking devices on the Secret Service vehicle? So then you start getting into the really confusing and convoluted PSYOP upon PSYOP where you're like, would Israel want us thinking that for some reason? Why would they want us thinking that's the case? Would that be to throw off the fact that Trump is working for them? That they would, you know, have this the evidence that they were the ones spying on him and tracking him? It's like they wouldn't do that if he was on their team. Did I fall for it? Is that why this was allowed to be known? But I'm not really ready to accept that fully. And we have an interesting video from Tucker Carlson that might, you know, hint at more than this. So I don't know. I'm not sure if he's on their team or not, to be honest with you. I'm pretty convinced he's doing absolutely everything that they want and destroying the Republican Party and America and, you know, enriching himself. But I don't think it was always like that. I don't know why they would install Stingray devices if, again, maybe they got away with it because he was there. So maybe they just installed it there knowing they would get away with it. I guess there are a couple different options. And you have this. This is from the New York Times article. The report, which incorporated contributions from a number of military intelligence agencies, also detailed several episodes in recent years. In 2021, Israeli military intelligence officers were caught planting listening devices at DIA headquarters. Last year, officers from Shin Bet, Israel's domestic intelligence agency, were discovered to have tried planting a listening device in a Secret Service vehicle. Remember, the vehicle they're talking about is the ambulance that would transport Trump should a assassination attempt be tried. Meanwhile, it's kind of small, it's hard to read. The Israeli cyber intelligence firm that shared the same building as Apple is the NSO Group. So the NSO Group apparently is very close to Apple. The company, known for its Pegasus software, previously maintained offices at the same complex as Apple's Research and Development Center in Herzliya Putyatk, Israel. The proximity drew significant media attention due to the highly adversarial relationship between the two companies. Apple filed a major federal lawsuit against NSO Group for targeting Apple users with sophisticated zero-click software exploits. Due to the dispute and shifting business needs, NSO Group relocated to a different office complex in the area. So again, whether it's, you know, big tech, AI, they're all being either pressured or manipulated or probably blackmailed by Israel to silence the criticisms, the valid and accurate criticisms of the genocidal state. Again, from New York Times, Pentagon sees growing espionage threat from Israel. And they go through just a few of the examples of the Israeli spying at an especially sensitive time. Israel and the U.S. have been fighting the war in Iran together and have never had such close military coordination as they do now. And so this is another part that I'm just being honest. I don't know what to make of this. And it's because we're operating in a world of shadows and mirrors and deception. And we've expressed many times confusion at the way Trump treats Bibi Netanyahu, for example. Somebody who he has tweeted out is a warmongering bastard. He has cursed him out about, you know, congratulating Joe Biden before the counting was done. And yet he's like every day writing a love letter on a handmade Valentine, begging the president of Israel to pardon Bibi because he's just such a magnificent human. So it's like, I guess I kind of, and, you know, again, you can kind of make up all sorts of reasons why they'd be doing this, and each is kind of more valid than the last. I mean, I think the obvious assumption is that Trump is beholden to Israel and beholden to Netanyahu and is, you know, I don't know, being forced to do it somehow or another, you know, begging for the pardons. Again, it just doesn't make any sense on the face of it. Then it's like, okay, maybe Trump really is like this BB guy keeps starting wars because he's going to go to jail for corruption. Please pardon him so we can stop the wars. Like, maybe that's where he's coming from. I don't know. Again, I'm not going to try to, you know, pull a muscle trying to justify Trump's actions with Israel. But it's one of these litmus tests, kind of like Rorschach tests, where you go, no, Trump is actually, you know, the reason he wants Bibi to be pardoned is because he actually wants to stop Israel waging these wars. And so he needs Bibi to not be under threat. But I don't know. There are lots of strategic reasons why you could go one way or the other. But then you've got things like what happened over the weekend. And I guess they moved it up a day because last week I started Monday by going, I just need to record a message I play every Monday. It did happen again. Only this time it was like kind of over the weekend where Trump was saying there's a ceasefire agreement there and Netanyahu is bombing Lebanon and Trump is saying I'm the one who calls the shots. But Bibi is saying I have to say no to the president of America sometimes. And it's like, are they really at odds? Is it really a power struggle going on? Because Israel bombed Iran this weekend. Israel bombed Iran. Israel cannot bomb Iran without American help. They don't have the tankers to refuel over Iraq. They need our help. So Trump is saying we're not going to help them, but then we obviously are because they bombed Iran and they can't bomb Iran without our help. But then other reports are saying that when Iran bombed Israel this weekend, America didn't help intercept the missiles and that Trump was in a way coming through with this promise of saying, if you guys keep this up, you're on your own. America's not going to come rescue you. So what's the truth? I think it's anybody's speculation. I assume Trump knows, but I don't even know if he does. I mean, who knows at this point? Who knows? Because none of it really makes sense no matter how you cut it. So all I can assume is that it's all deception all the way down. That to me, that seems like the safe approach. Otherwise, it's like, okay, Trump doesn't want Israel doing this, but we are helping them to bomb Iran. It just doesn't make any sense. And maybe it doesn't make sense because they're lying. Like maybe, you know, Trump putting his foot down is a lie, as I've thought it was a few times in the past. Because again, the reasoning starts with Israel gambled it all on this push to become a superpower. They have put it all on the table. They understand this is their last chance ever. If they don't get it now, maybe they got a couple years they can hang on. But like every day that goes on, Israel is less likely to pull this off. They're not going to get another chance like the chance they have now. They have to keep pushing. They have to make this work. And I mean, maybe I'm paranoid here, but you've got like this seeming break between Israel and America as America is seemingly with Trump at the helm going, we're sick of this. We're not going to, you know, go along with this. And so the war seems like it's coming to an end with no major event kickstarting it again. It could just fizzle out, in which case Israel, yes, they will have gained some of Gaza, but they will have destroyed their reputation overseas. Iran will be more powerful than they were when they began. I mean, they're looking down the barrel of extinction in 10 years if things just sort of fizzle out here. And we're 3 days away from the start of the World Cup in America. Are these things, maybe these things are not related. Maybe they're totally separate. But I can't help but see everything kind of coming to a head. I can't help but be a bit concerned at the lack of forward movement in the investigation of people going into the tunnels under New York City. I can't help but see America in this state of chaos as we're about to kickstart the biggest international event the world holds. I mean, the World Cup is bigger than the Olympics by far. It's all across America. They're doing it in LA and New York and Kansas City and Houston and Seattle. And I mean, and Mexico and Toronto and all these, you know, international places as well. Monterrey and Mexico City, I know, are on the list. It's a pretty big security operation, you know, that we're going to try to pull off here. And as far as I can tell, our security situation in America, it's not any better than it was when Biden was in charge and opening up the border to tens of millions of hostile foreigners from somewhere, from parts unknown, for motives unknown. I think we've been in false flag, red alert territory for a while. But I've said over and over, if there is going to be some sort of false flag attack to fully get us in. Oh, and then they're like admitting that Iran has nuclear weapons. And I'm just like, are they setting this up? Are they really setting up? Because it would have to be something. It would have to be because everybody's so suspicious. Everybody knows now what's going on. But what if you have a stadium full of people die on live TV? What if it happens again the next day? Like, what would the reaction be from the American people? Would we be able to say, hey, look, we know this is Israel and we're not going to stand for it? Or would we say, I don't want to get blown up by a nuke. Do what you want, government. Just protect me. Meanwhile, U.S. military personnel in Israel found secret spyware on their phones as Congress pushes U.S. military merger from ibtimes.co.uk. U.S. defense personnel stationed in Israel discovered their communications intercepting software had been secretly installed on their mobile phones, prompting the Pentagon's intelligence arm to raise the espionage threat from a key ally to its highest ever level. Well, you know, once again, you know, you've got the Hezbollah pager attacks. You've got the S-300 being programmed not to attack Israeli jets. You also have the way Syria was taken over, in which the Syrian army had all of their phones hacked because an app that was pushed by the First Lady of Syria was actually Israeli spyware. They gave them access to the phone and they could intercept, destroy, or send fake messages, totally destroying the ability of the army to coordinate. And so it made an easy job to overrun them with the Islamic Horde under the ISIS commander, Jolani. So, like, this is what Israel does. This is what they're good at. This is how they win. This is where they pour all of their money and effort and time. And we're going to let them merge themselves to us, tie us to them at the hip, when literally every one of their major successes in the past decade has been the direct result of hacking or manipulating technology somehow. Again, beyond absurd, beyond absurd. Angry Pentagon sources leak reports of Israel's unhinged spying on U.S. officials. It's no secret, this is from Zero Hedge, it's no secret that Israeli spying and surveillance is pervasive, and it's often directed at the most powerful ally and backer, the U.S. But the phenomenon has escalated of late, outraging Washington intelligence officials. Behind the scenes of this alliance, which mainstream media pundits typically protect as essentially untouchable, deep-seated friction is boiling over. In an unprecedented move, the Pentagon has officially elevated Israel's counterintelligence threat level to the highest possible category, driven by surging internal alarm that this primary Mideast regional ally is aggressively ramping up espionage operations targeting senior U.S. officials, even Trump's own top Iran negotiator. Who, Jared Kushner? Wait a second. They're spying on Jared Kushner? I don't think so. I think he works for them. So again, this is all part of the whole of government takeover. GenXGirl.substack.com has the story. GenXGirl.substack.com. She is on X at GenXGirl1994. The whole of government entrenchment of Israeli influence is advancing through coordinated legislation that subordinates U.S. intelligence, defense, and foreign policy priorities to Tel Aviv's agenda at the expense of American sovereignty, interests, and taxpayers. Once again, goes through all of the various resolutions proposed in the last couple of months by people of the Democrat and Republican persuasion. And, you know, it's not like there's one bill that's just like, we will be subjects of Israel. We're all going to be slaves. But each one of these is a part of a singular construction for which that is the truth. These measures represent a dangerous erosion of U.S. autonomy by locking in American taxpayers, innovators, and warfighters into perpetual one-way technology transfers and industrial dependencies that benefit a foreign nation first, dilute focus on domestic manufacturing, risk entangling in the U.S. and Middle East conflicts, and treat Israel's security as inseparable from America's despite diverging interests, massive ongoing costs, and opposition to the U.S.-Israeli relationship by a majority of Americans. This is incremental capture of key levers of the U.S. government power by a foreign country, Israel. This article will focus on Section 2.2 622 of the Senate FY27 Intelligence Authorization Act, which has received little attention from the public. Of course, that's what the John Bowne report exposed yesterday that Alex showed you, and I hope you've shared on your ex. And again, you go, I mean, you really should, you know, go through and read this because it's got some really interesting, you know, aspects of it that I haven't seen talked about anywhere else. Things like forced expansion to Abraham Accords countries. The bill requires the U.S. to expand intelligence sharing and analytic cooperation with any nations that normalize relationships with Israel under the Abraham Accords framework. Priority areas include counterterrorism, cyber, air, missile defense, and maritime security. This effectively uses U.S. intelligence as diplomatic glue to advance a specific regional architecture, whether Americans support it or not. American foreign policy becomes the enforcer or quartermaster for Israel's normalization deals. If Israel wants closer ties with Gulf states, they should manage the intelligence dimensions themselves and perhaps start by not being a genocidal pariah state. Dragging America deeper into integrated Middle East security architecture increases entanglement risks and tripwires for U.S. involvement in future conflicts, which is one of a number of, you know, poison pills that no sovereign country would ever be okay with. And we're only okay with it because Israel has systematically bought out our entire government over the last several decades and nobody's doing anything about it. So we'll move on here. Trump kind of embarrassed himself in interviews over the weekend. However, I mean, I agree with him walking off because, you know, the libs are stupid. And this, but this is sort of the problem that I've had with Trump the entire time, which is that, like, when he's going off the cuff, when he's sparring with a person in the media, he's great. He's amazing. He can insult them. He can, you know, hit them back with something. But I'd always complain every time Trump would do something like this. I would complain that the way he was talking was incomprehensible to regular people because he would reference things that, like, I know about and Alex Jones knows about, but that just sound insane to normal people because he doesn't explain it. He doesn't actually explain why he believes what he believes. He's right about what he's saying. Why does he not have the ability to explain it? It makes no sense. And I'd always go, this is one time. There were so many times that it was like, this is one time where Trump, all he needs to do is read a freaking script. In 2020, this was like the biggest deal because there was so much overwhelming evidence of voter fraud. And yet he never explained it. Nobody on his team ever explained it. And I remember the time being like, for the love of God, Trump, like, this is in between, you know, him getting, you know, losing the 2020 election and then January 6th. It was like, we're just begging Trump, please, Trump, just look at the camera and read a teleprompter, have your best assistants just compile all of the evidence and just go through, because the media will air it. They'll air a primetime presidential address and you'll have the eyes of the nation and you can actually lay out the verifiable evidence of the fraud that is all around us, that exists in overabundant quantities, and yet he never can do that. He can never explain stuff that he should be able to explain. It's so annoying. It's so annoying because he looks like an idiot and it makes everybody else think that he has no reason to believe what he believes. So I'll go to that video and some other videos from Trump. Now, on the other hand, he is just lying about, you know, never saying no new wars. He did say no new wars, so, you know, half of it is like reasonable, half of it is unreasonable. But at the end of the day, if you could sit there and enunciate why mail-in voting is fraudulent, then we could probably end it. Instead, he gets mad and runs away. Great.
地域の投票に不正があった。汚れた投票だった。 そして今まさにカリフォルニアで起きている。あなたは一度も証拠を提示していない。
いつかたってもまだ結果が出てる。そうやって数えるんです。バカげてる。それはクソってる。お前と同じようにな。ミートザプレスもクソってる。私はクソっていない。お前はクソってるか、バカか、そのどちらかだ。もう終わりにしよう。十分時間は与えた。ありがとう、お嬢さん。お願いします。ウィスコンシンから悪まる来たんです。十分過ぎつな報道機関がある限り、この国が偉大になることは決してない。
Another absolute masterpiece by PSYOP Anime. PSYOP Anime does it again. You really make Trump look cool. As I say, I don't actually know if PSYOP Anime is a girl or not. Incredible stuff. News would be a lot easier to bear if it was all cool anime like that. But yeah, obviously Trump walked out of this Meet the Press interview when challenged over, as they put it, false claim from Washington Post. When pressed by host Kristen Welker, the president cited no evidence for claims about January 6th and elections were said to be rigged. And again, why does he believe it if he can't explain it? I believe that the election in 2020 was stolen, and I can explain it in detail. I can explain it in a way that is just, unimpeachable logically, and you can get into the details and explain the actual instances of fraud that were well known, reported on, but never actually investigated. You can go through the timeline of how these things were covered up. We have the firsthand eyewitness testimony of people like the DA in Pennsylvania who was investigating the voter fraud when Bill Barr swooped in and said, "Don't worry, we're handling this. You don't investigate it." And then it didn't go anywhere. Like, you could go through not just the way it was carried out, but the way it was covered up. I mean, you could go bit by bit, but really all you need to say is mail-in ballots cannot be verified. They can't be. There's no way to verify a mail-in ballot. It's impossible. You can try. You can maybe get okay at it, but there's absolutely no possible way to guarantee that the person who put the vote in the envelope and put it in the mailbox is the person on the envelope. There's no way to guarantee that these ballots aren't stolen or thrown away if they, don't vote for the right person. You do not have a chain of custody. You cannot guarantee the votes are who they say they are. No election that has a sizable number of mail-in ballots, or that mail-in ballots exist as an elective possibility rather than, an out-of-state, solution for a problem that is minimal and extraordinary circumstances. When you have mail-in ballots as a just equal part of the election, it is an invalid election on the face of it, because the technology does not exist to accurately tell who is voting for what. He can't express that. He can't lay that out there. He can't ask them, how do you confirm a mail-in ballot is who it says it is? They have no answer. There's no way to do it. Oh, well, we check the signature. Okay, but the signature doesn't match half the time. Or we can find somebody's signature pretty damn easily. But that also doesn't explain what happens if the ballots get thrown away. Or the innumerable examples we have of ballots being thrown away, being found in dumpsters, or being, discovered in boxes long after the election. The whole thing is absurd. And I agree with Trump, but he doesn't do it any justice. He doesn't actually explain why he believes what he believes, and so it allows them to write headlines like that. And the only conclusion you can come to if you're not pro-Trump is, he doesn't have any reason to believe it. He's just saying it's fake. He has no reason to say that. And if he did, he would explain it, but he doesn't, so he walks off and huffs like a baby. So all he's done is actually confirm the suspicion of those people that there's no reason why they think it's fraud. They just say that because they don't like losing. Like, dude, you can't explain something for once. Watching us on Rumble, you can find us at rumble.com/thewarroomlive. Rumble.com/thewarroomlive is how you find the official broadcast, and we upload all of the shows there. I know a lot of people, we have a lot of listeners that tune in every day, but I've found that ever since moving away from American Journal, apparently 3 o'clock, people are working a lot. And they don't like to watch it live, but you can always watch the full episode. It always, rebroadcast on that Rumble stream. You can also always find it at alexjoneslive.com. As soon as this show's over, it loops back again and plays for 24 hours until we do the next show. So you should be able to find it live there, or, watch it at your leisure. Of course, with the Rumble app, you can minimize it. Here's a little trick for the Rumble app, in case you don't know, because I use the Rumble app all the time. It's how I listen back to my show to learn what I said, because I forget as soon as the show's over. If you go to Rumble and you follow, then it'll be up at the It'll be up at the top every time we go live. So you just open your Rumble homepage and you go right up to the top. Yeah, hit that follow button for sure so that you're following us. And then it appears at the top and you hit that button. And then what you need to do is minimize it. So it goes into the little box. Like if you're using an iPhone, you swipe up from the bottom, because if you just turn your phone off, then it will go silent. But if you minimize it first and then turn your phone off, the audio continues. So you can actually, you know, listen to it while you're going around doing stuff or driving or whatever. You don't have to have your screen on. You don't have to be, well, I don't know. I imagine it's not downloading the video. I imagine you're using less bandwidth. I don't know if that's actually true, but I do know that I often pull up the show on Rumble, hit play, then I minimize it, turn off the screen and just listen to it like a podcast. That's a very easy way to do it. No excuses. I always hear people, I don't know where to find your show. It's right there. It's right there. The War Room Live, rumble.com/The War Room Live. So Trump had sort of, there were sort of two headlines out of the interview he did with Kristen Welker. The first was that he walked off because she challenged his claim about voter fraud. Now, I saw a comment that had a good response to this, which is that if it's a Democrat alleging voter fraud, then the media landscape, the MSM out there, investigates those claims. They actually do their job. They actually perform journalism, and they go to see if these claims have any merit. If it's Republicans who claim it, they just write it off without doing any research and then demand that you present evidence. Do you see the difference? If you make a claim that affects Democrats, they go find the evidence. If you are a Republican, they demand that you come with the evidence already supplied. They're the ones who are supposed to find it. They're the ones who are supposed to investigate it. They don't investigate it and then say, we have no evidence. It's actually pretty broad. It's actually the entire argument as to why the 2020 election was not fraudulent is they say, basically, we didn't investigate, so there's no proof. We didn't look into it, so therefore it didn't happen. That's literally that's what the claim is, because they say basically you don't have any evidence. But we do have plenty of evidence, but they say, but that doesn't count because it wasn't in a courtroom, it wasn't in a trial, it wasn't in the New York Times, so how could it be real? Okay, so we have the evidence. The mainstream media won't talk about it. The mainstream media won't investigate it. The mainstream media won't falsify or verify the claims that are made. The powers that be deliberately shut down investigations into this by claiming to be handling it at the national level, and then it never gets handled at the national level. When court cases are brought, judges throw it out without even looking at the evidence on the basis of standing or whatever other excuse that they can throw out there, because they always have one. Judges can kind of do whatever they want, justify it however they want. So then they go, well, no evidence. They do not investigate. They stop you from presenting evidence, and then they use the lack of evidence as proof that it doesn't exist. That's very annoying, but it's easy to get around if you have the knowledge in your mind. If you can actually explain how it's done, or even like I did, explain the basic physical reality behind mail-in ballots and the impossibility of ever guaranteeing they are who they say they are. Or, you know, again, I'm the only person I've ever heard talk about the Detroit leaks. What do I have to do to get other people to find out about the Detroit leaks? I've played them on this show like 100 times. I've never heard anybody bring them up. They are absolute dead to rights proof that the 2020 election was stolen, and nobody talks about it. It's crazy. I'm not going to play them here again because I've played them so many damn times already. You just go look it up. Go find it yourself, because I don't know what I can do. But literally in the Detroit training for the vote counters, they are training them how to avoid oversight. They are training them to use mail-in ballots, even if the person is there in person, face-to-face, saying, I did not send in a mail-in ballot. The vote counters were instructed, give that person a provisional ballot, have them fill out the provisional ballot, say, thank you for voting today, sir, and then throw that provisional ballot in the trash and use the envelope that arrived a week earlier that he said he never sent. They literally trained the people to use mail-in ballots, even if the person was there in person with their ID, confirming their identification, saying, I never sent in a mail-in ballot. The people were trained to ignore that and count the mail-in ballot that had their name on it. It's on audio. It's explicit. Nobody's done anything about it ever. Like if I was asked for one rock solid dead to rights proof that the election was stolen. It's that. It's that they were literally trained how to do it, and we have the audio of them being trained how to do it. And I've played it on the show a million times. I don't know if Trump's ever heard of that, but it might be something to bring up next time they ask you for proof that the election is stolen. You might want to have like one or two examples on hand to explain. It's not complicated. And here you are with a chance to make the case to the American people. Here you are in a national interview, knowing that you're going to be asked about this, knowing this is one of the biggest stories in the country right now with what's happening with Spencer Pratt, where the Democrats in LA are flagrantly stealing the election in front of everybody. The woman who has now overtaken Spencer Pratt dropped out of the race last week because it was mathematically impossible for her to win. Now she's in second place. Mathematically impossible. Story at alexjoneslive.com. Questions are piling up fast as Pratt suddenly loses second place in LA mayoral vote. Okay, so that's very frustrating. It's very frustrating that Trump never once has bothered to explain voter fraud. Again, like it, you know, because it's not like he just avoided the topic. That would be something. If he just avoided the topic outright, then you could watch that interview and not come to a conclusion one way or another. Instead, by getting up and storming out when asked very simply to provide any example of voter fraud, for which, again, there are dozens. People have been arrested and sent to jail. There have been federal cases about voter fraud, specifically with mail-in ballots. There was a woman like yesterday. They got convicted for it. He can't bring that up. He doesn't know about that. He can't throw that back in their face. So they ask him, you say it's stolen. Why? Why do you think that's stolen? He goes, I don't have to talk to you anymore. You're crooked, and gets up and leaves. All that does is reinforce the lefty view that he doesn't have a reason to believe it, which must mean we don't have a reason to believe it, which must mean that Trump is just lying to us baselessly and we're believing him because we're idiots. And really all that's happening is we're losing elections and mad that we're losing elections and lying about it to try to scheme our way back into power. That's the outcome of the way Trump behaved. That's the conclusion people watching are going to come to if they don't already know that the elections have been stolen. Yeah, the yellow line on screen is Pratt, and again, the numbers, the problems with this are overwhelming. And again, you could just point to a few of them. I mean, just that one image alone of the. I mean, it's the same thing that's happening. It's the same, and that, like, again, this is the frustration. Is like, here's this extremely important thing. Here's something that Trump himself made a cornerstone of his entire campaign in 2024, fixing the voter fraud, fixing the mail-in ballot crap. This is like an existential problem for America. Here's Trump with a perfect chance to not only explain how the 2020 election was stolen, but use as an example a race that is currently being stolen as we speak, and that they're using exactly the same strategy on both of those. So he's given this opportunity to say, do you want to know how it was stolen? Look at these graphs. 100,000 votes for Biden, not a single one for Trump. That is a fraudulent tranche of documents. That is statistically impossible. It cannot happen. And guess what? It's happening again in LA with Spencer Pratt and his socialist opponent, who is receiving tranches of thousands of votes without a single one for Spencer Pratt. She is somehow in third place, but has more mail-in votes than the current first place, Karen Bass. That's statistically impossible, damn near impossible, deeply unlikely. I mean, you could go on and on with stuff like this and say this is happening right now. They're doing it in exactly the same way because mail-in ballots will never be successfully implemented in America or anywhere else for that matter. It's not necessary. It doesn't. The problem that it claims it's solving doesn't actually exist. The whole thing is set up, and the parameters of how it works are only in place and only make sense if there's fraud. It's completely bonkers. We'll go to some videos about this. Let's go to clip 47 here. This is Jay Clayton on CNBC. This is how obvious the voter fraud is. This is CNBC, which is like one of the most lefty outlets out there. And they can't help but admit that Trump's got a point. So it's like, again, this is the crazy part. Trump's got this position that he holds that is contrary to the mainstream media. He is correct, and he could easily smack them down with it with just like three or four little soundbite things to mention. He doesn't do that. He's made to look like a total idiot, when in reality, this is a softball underhand pitch. He could knock it out of the park. He's so correct on this that the people at CNBC are tying themselves in knots trying to claim that voter fraud doesn't exist. They can't even do that. All they can do is try to downplay it. And yet, he loses out on the exchange with a leftist over this exact topic. Let's watch CNBC. I'll pause and comment.
Idea of what's happening in California right now?
No, I actually can't, which I think is the problem. You know, you raised this about election integrity, which I think is the point.
I'm watching it, and are any of the things we're hearing about, like thousands of votes all for the same person, is any of that true, or is that just this sort of conspiracy, like 100% for the socialist candidate versus the others? Is any of that true?
Well, look, we had a problem. A deep problem with voting.
All right, let's pause it right there. Like, you can tell just from the jump, they're not talking about something they want to talk about or that they even know how to talk about. It's not like, what do you make of these ridiculous claims Trump is making? 1,000 documents. There's no such thing, right? And the other guy's like, absolutely not. It's another BS from the Trump administration. You know, we should be used to this by now. You don't have that energy. You don't have that smoothness. It's all, what about some of these claims? These aren't real, are they? I mean, we have like thousands of documents for the social. I mean, this is crazy, right? This is crazy. And the DA's like, well, let me talk about racism. Well, we have a racism problem in this country. It's like, all right, done. Voter fraud is real. Like, I don't need to see any more. We have just seen more than enough for me to understand voter fraud is absolutely real. Jay Clayton, the district attorney for the Southern District of New York, absolutely knows it's real. The people on CNBC absolutely know it's real. And let's watch as they try to avoid that reality. Okay, so he was just asked a very simple question. Are any of these stories real? The claims that tranches of mail-in ballots are showing up a week after election was held that are 100% for the socialist mayor and not a single vote for anybody else. Is that real? Did that really happen? Are those claims valid? And now the district attorney starts going into a rambling and uncertain response about the problem of racism in this country. Okay, let's watch.
We had race-based discrimination around voting that was identified. We had the Voting Rights Act. It was all about access, making sure that people were not denied access.
Yeah, in the 60s.
There was a second element to it, which was election integrity. Making sure that once everybody has access, that their vote actually counts, that it's not being diluted by illegal voting or shenanigans and the like. I think we've done, you know, a pretty darn good job on access. I don't hear anybody claiming that they don't have access to the ballot box.
What too much
access. Politicians saying that it's Jim Crow disenfranchisement.
So let's pause it here, because that is a very funny response. That is a very funny response. The Southern District of New York Attorney General, District Attorney, whatever he is like, look, there's not an issue with ballot access. It doesn't exist. We solved this problem in the 1960s. It's illegal to block people. It's illegal to, you know, force them to take a literacy. Yeah, it doesn't exist. Voter intimidation isn't legal. Like, that's not a problem. That doesn't exist. And then the other guy responds, well, politicians say it's Jim Crow 2.0, which is hilarious. And the guy's like, yeah, well, it's not, though. No, you're both right. No, you're both exactly right. There's nothing contradictory about this. The problem doesn't exist, and politicians talk about it all the time as if it does, and they pursue and promote and put forward solutions to the problem that doesn't exist because they're trying to do something else, because they're not trying to fix a problem. They're actually creating other problems by making everything sound like a racist attack. So I just thought that exchange was hysterical. this problem doesn't exist. And the news reporter's like, but politicians are always saying it does. It's like, yeah, accurate. Both of those statements are accurate. Thank you for that. Let's go back.
We have groups dedicated to making sure that people have access. Tons of money dedicated to it. You know, laws and laws that my office enforces, other offices enforce to make sure that people... On the integrity side, we're doing an absolutely terrible job. And the American people are right to question it. How come we can have an audit trail in every other aspect of our lives that's important? People cite getting on, you know, planes and the like and things, but, you know, in every...
Jay, here's the issue. California's election law...
Oh, God interrupt him. God interrupt. We didn't even know the woman was there. I didn't even know there was a woman in this conversation. Where did she come from? She just spawned in. Uh-oh. Uh-oh, the Democrat guy is saying Trump is right. You better have a woman jump in and interrupt him. Where the hell did she come from? I thought this was an interview. Did you hear her mic wasn't even up? They had to crank her mic up when she started talking. So, yeah, let's go back to it. So, you know, he's like, hey, look, we solved voter access. No problem. The other guy interrupts. Well, but don't politicians? He's like, yeah, that's... Yes, they do lie about that. They do say it's Jim Crow 2.0. It's a complete lie. It doesn't exist. Don't be a retard is the underlying sentiment I think he was trying to express. And then he's like, but, you know, the other side of that is voter integrity, and we have no voter integrity. People are right to be concerned about this. We have no ability to have a chain of custody. And oh, the woman interrupts. Well, hold on here a minute. Let's see what she has to say.
By election day to be counted and permit same day registration. That means tabulation typically continues for weeks after the vote.
I think you go 30 days, isn't it?
Right.
But why is that law there? I get you.
That doesn't sound like fraud. That you can argue whether the law makes sense, but that doesn't sound like a fraudulent situation.
No, there's a great phrase: opportunity for fraud. Right. One of the things you do in designing laws is reduce the opportunity for fraud without, in this case, reduce the opportunity for fraud while not adversely impacting
access. And every time it happens, Jay, it's like, okay, all these are coming in for the next 30 days. Oh, Democrats vote that way, so it just makes sense that it's 100% Democrat. That's where the opportunity comes from. So,
right.
Yeah, you can have it. Why does it always go that way with the mail-in votes? Why is it always 100% Democrats are voting in the mail-in?
Or why can't you count them like they do in other jurisdictions on the same day as election day or within a very reasonable
time?
Well,
if you mail them in on election day, they're not going to be there on election day.
Well,
I got stuff returned to me that I sent out for Christmas by like 2 months later.
Call me crazy. It seems like maybe the U.S. Postal Service isn't the way we should be voting. You ever think about that? This is just like where we are. This is just like where we're at. There's something that should never exist. Mail-in voting, it never should exist. It never did exist until they locked down the entire country, forced us to all stay inside so they could get mail-in voting. Without the lockdown, mail-in voting would not exist at this moment. It was never a thing. A few states did it, I guess. It's fine, but the whole nationwide... And the mail-in voting provisions had no... guarantees for safety, nothing of what he's talking about. Of course, he was interrupted again. What he was trying to say was, what we're trying to do is solve the legitimacy problem without lowering access. He couldn't finish that thought, but it's certainly possible to do that. But again, they put us on lockdown from the disease that they released and then didn't tell us about. They wanted us on lockdown for a couple reasons: to crash the economy, to create the food shortages, to force the vaccine. But I think most importantly, to get the mail-in ballots. That's the only reason they exist, genuinely. So it shouldn't exist in the first place. It was put into place temporarily, ostensibly temporarily, and on emergency provision. So there's no extra work or thought put into it. This wasn't passed by the legislature, which is the legal way that you change the voting system. The legislature is supposed to do it. So the Secretary of State's just assumed that power to themselves, totally illegal. They have no precedent, no justification for doing this, except for the emergency that they themselves declared about the disease that they themselves released. But they do it. They force it through. They make it you know, with absolutely no guarantees of safety or ability to guarantee the vote is who they say it is. And then it's just that's the way it is forever. And now we're having to try to come up with ways to solve problems with the system that we set up that we never needed in the first place, was illegitimate in the first place, and should have expired the first year that it was used. But it just remains, and it just is the way that we vote now, and all of the problems that everybody notices are incumbent on this system just go unaddressed, ignored, or impotently complained about, and our elections keep getting stolen. This is crazy. Let's finish the clip here.
Election day for mail-in ballots, I don't
really.
But those are questions with the law, and yes. It doesn't suggest that there's necessarily fraud here. You can have cause for an investigation, but with the governor's office.
The vote totals that come in suggest.
Becky, I completely agree with you. Yeah. It's what it does.
I'm not saying there's not fraud. I'm just saying there's not necessarily fraud there. And that's
what it is it makes the opportunity for fraud so much greater when that is not necessary. It is not.
Yeah, I mean, it's just. It's unnecessary. It's obviously fraudulent. And I'll say again, there is no way to guarantee. There is no way. There's no way. You can't even go in afterwards and audit it. Because, yes, you're going to have the mailed-in ballot. But unless you go through and contact every single person and get them to tell you who they voted for and cross-check it with the mail—no, it's impossible. It can never happen. This should not be allowed. I honestly wouldn't even blame Trump if he just said, I'm rejecting those results of this election and I'm installing a governor of California. I think he should do that, actually. So we got two options, folks. And honestly, I hope, I pray. I mean, for me to maintain any form of optimism, I have to believe that our elections are stolen. Otherwise, we got a way bigger problem on our hands. Okay. I hope our elections are stolen, because that would explain how some of these people get into office in the first place. Otherwise, I have to actually sit here and contend with a reality where the people of Seattle chose an unemployed moron to be their mayor and are fine with that, and are seeing what she's doing and are just think it's fine. And I refuse. I refuse to live in a reality where people actually support this person. I pray to God that it was stolen. I pray to God it was all stolen, because then it would explain. Then we'd be like, okay, all right, good. That's how the absolute moron gets elected as mayor of Seattle. This woman, people, you know, say what you want about Trump. He's a little brash, whatever. I have never seen idiocracy come to life like this woman. It is beyond parody. I'm about to show you a video of her answering questions, and it's I hope the election was stolen. I really do. I really hope people didn't vote for this woman, because that would really depress me and make me give up on humanity, because she doesn't know what the hell is going on. I mean, I don't know what's going on with her. Let's go to clip 11 here. I don't even have words for this. This is Seattle Mayor Katie Wilson. She bombed an interview with Fox 13's Hannah Kim at a recent civics event. Again, it's one thing. I'm trying to think, like, you know, Kamala Harris might be a good example of somebody that, like, she's obviously dumb as bricks. She obviously is unqualified for any position, let alone the ones that she's in. But she knows how to handle questions. Like, she knows how to sort of duck and weave politically, to where even if you're like, ah, this person is such a slime ball, they're so dishonest and underhanded, like, you know, it's off-putting, it's disgusting. But at least it's like, ah, but I see how she got to where she is. But dang, she's a slick one. But man, she really has got a way to wriggle out of that one. That was impressive. Like, she'll, you know, Kamala Harris, Joe Biden, they could still sort of pull that stuff off. AOC is another one. Well, she's not quite as good, because she kind of embraced her stupidity and nobody cared. So, you know, I always point to the interview very early on when she was actually asked about Israel and Palestine. And she literally is like, you know, I haven't thought about that. I'm gonna have to ask my team about that. You should probably have answers for these things. It's not a great look as a congressman to admit, like, Let me ask my handlers how I should answer that one and get back to you. Let me upgrade my teleprompter and then I will have an opinion on that. Oh, okay. So you're like a puppet person. Cool. Very cool. But at least, like, you know, she also has some sort of rhetorical skill that she can handle things. This woman, it's like, if you're going to be an idiot, if you're going to be a tyrant and a, you know, progressive psychopath, you got to at least be a little bit clever. You got to at least be able to dress it up a little bit. I think you'll see what I mean. I think you'll understand exactly what I'm saying. Seattle Mayor Katie Wilson, who until she was mayor, and I guess still now, I don't know, where's the mayor live? I assume she still lives with her parents. She lived with her parents. She's never had a job. She's as dumb as a box of rocks. Let's watch.
City Club and Fox 13 held a forum with Seattle Mayor Katie Wilson last night. She garnered national scrutiny recently for her comments toward the business community, including when she called for a boycott of Starbucks. Here's one exchange from last night.
Let's start with Starbucks. Do you still support a boycott of Starbucks?
You know, I had the pleasure of visiting the Pike Place Market Starbucks a little while ago, and I ordered a blueberry muffin latte. That was like a staff creation. So
that's a
I broke my boycott.
Okay.
But I don't know. What do you want me to say about that?
Let's pause it. Okay, so if I asked 100 people to name a company from Seattle, I bet 99.9 of them would name Starbucks. It's like very closely related to Seattle. It's where they got their start. It's like very tied in. That brand is tied into the city. And it's like, I can think of 10 different ways to answer this differently, right? You could go, oh, yeah, you know, that was about something in particular. You know, we really made some good. That was an important boycott. I think boycotting is an important tool in the toolkit for citizens, you know, to oppose things they disagree with. And I think citizens should always have the right to boycott. I, however, do enjoy Starbucks, and I don't hate the brand. I just, you know, but I would never say it. You know, like, there are just ways to respond. But she's just like, well, I got a Starbucks the other day, so I don't know. you're the mayor of a major American city. She's just like, why, what do you want me to say? It's like, I don't know, answer the question. Like, what? It's crazy. It's genuinely crazy. They voted for her. It's nuts. Yeah, I'd say even Microsoft is more related than Amazon. The crew was saying Amazon's, you know, associated with Seattle, but, like, I don't know. Amazon's more of a, you know, it's not human enough to be associated with a place. It just sort of exists wherever, you know, robots live. It, you know, it doesn't really have a temporal home. Its home is the pits of hell, and it has temporal manifestations of its ethereal evil. Amazon doesn't really come from a certain place. It just arises from the depths. But Starbucks, it's like, it's the coffee. It's like got a whole vibe. It's got a Seattle vibe going with it. So again, she's just like, what do you want me to say? Okay. This is, by the way, friendly interview, friendly discussion with a friendly show asking softball questions. She can't answer them. Let's go back.
When I asked about Spencer Pratt, the L.A. mayoral candidate recently called the mayor out. He said people in L.A. living on the streets doing drugs will come to Seattle when he cuts them off. Pratt saying Wilson will welcome them into Seattle. Take a listen to what Mayor Wilson had to say.
I'm not going to respond to him, but I will respond to you all. Let's pause right there.
Because that is a weird lefty thing. That it's like, Spencer Pratt is unworthy of being addressed. I will not respond to him. Like, as if what he's saying is so crazy. It's like, I won't even dignify it with an answer. It's like, but what are you going to do when he sends all the homeless people here? well, what are you going to do if he becomes mayor of the city? But it doesn't matter. It could literally, you know, it could be, he could be a Nobel Prize winner. They would still treat him with this level of disdain because it's an easy go-to shortcut when you don't actually have an answer for anything. You can just pretend to be above it. It's the same reason people say conspiracy theorists or call you crazy. It's like, then you don't have to actually contend with the question being asked. So she's above it all. And again, I just love this leftist strategy, and you see it everywhere, right? But it's like, Spencer Pratt said he's going to do this if he becomes mayor. How will you respond to that? And she can't just answer like a normal human being. First, she has to signal to everybody out there that she hates Spencer Pratt and refuses to see him as a human being. And, you know, I'll talk to you. I'll answer you, but I'm not going to respond to him. He is not worthy of my response. It's like, bitch, you're not worthy to flush his toilet. So what are you talking about? Okay. So let's see what answer she has to say, because this is kind of a tricky one for her. It's kind of tricky. I don't know which way she goes with this, because she either has to say, yes, we will welcome all the homeless people, which I don't think the people in Seattle would be all that happy with. Or she's going to say, no, we don't want more homeless people, which is kind of at odds with her entire political ideology. So let's see how she handles this one.
Very clear when we look at the data, when we look at different cities around the country and kind of compare the scale of our homelessness issues. What is driving homelessness is housing costs. There is a very, very clear correlation between housing costs and homelessness.
Is Seattle too lenient on giving people who
are— So she didn't answer the question. Long story short. Okay. It's just like, I don't know, man. Are people watching this like, a good point? Housing, you know, if somebody can't afford a home, I have the feeling that's because they can't afford a home. If they're living in somewhere that's not a home, that might be because they can't afford to live in a home. Okay. Great. Again, do people watch this and they go, see, she's got her finger on the pulse. She understands the issues. Is that what's happening? Because I prefer to believe that our elections are stolen. I have to believe that she is where she is today as a result of some giant prank than the people of Seattle actually being this retarded. I can't do it. I can't believe that about the city of Seattle. Please, Seattle. Please move me wrong. Yeah, this is them. All right, never mind. You know, the funny thing is that there was just a very big story and a big leftist paper called Bloomberg. Dallas housing market cools as H-1B visa Indian buyers vanish, talking about how immigration is directly responsible for the majority of the rise in house prices, and that by simply deporting or even just not bringing in infinite foreigners, housing prices drop precipitously. So I wonder if she'd be okay with, legal immigrants or legal immigrants being kept out to serve those experiencing homelessness. The answer is no, she will not do that. Okay. Back to, we really need a nickname for this lady. We'll think of one. We'll figure one out. To the big dumb idiot. Let's watch.
Drugs, housing first, with no requirement of drug treatment and rehabilitation. Why is that not something that is combined together?
So I'll say that, you know, people come into homelessness from all kinds of different directions. And people who are struggling with substance use disorder, drug addiction, right? Like, everyone has their individual situation, and what works for one person doesn't always work for another. And that is part of why it's really important that we have a variety of shelter options and that we have a variety of, you know, service models.
After my question and answer session with the mayor, community members were able to ask Wilson direct questions, and many of them focused on public safety. Fox 13's Alejandro Guzman shares some of their biggest concerns.
Public safety dominated the conversation, starting with Mayor Wilson's newly proposed sales tax to fund more bus services.
I am all for taxes when the system is working. but I'm not sure if I'm going to get home safely tonight.
Others shared stories of shootings, stabbings, and employees carrying whistles for their safety as businesses are paying for private security, claiming police never show up.
Because if you know, spend 10% of your revenue on private security, that's like an extra sales tax.
Do you know that almost 25 employees have had to use that whistle? They're not safe in downtown Seattle.
Some said they feel the candidate they campaigned for has turned their back on them.
You're talking about gun violence, and it's not at the top. We helped you campaign, and you forgot all about us.
Homelessness was another major topic.
When will the power washing stop?
Wilson said a new approach is coming to 12th and Jackson very soon.
Right now, we don't have a lot of options for people, which is part of why it feels like we're just moving people around, because in a sense, we are.
But this wasn't just a campaign talking point. It's a promise she's vowed to keep.
We can't just keep moving people from place to place and calling that progress.
Affordability and the future of Seattle's business community also took center stage. While some question how they can afford to stay in their homes, business owners are worried about downtown vacancies and whether companies will continue to invest in Seattle.
When are you going to come with concrete responses to the issues that will solve the problem?
That's the best question. Hold on, we got to pause it.
When are you going to answer our questions? When are you going to say anything substantive about anything we ask you? When are you going to provide a single solution to any of the innumerable problems that we are experiencing and that you are aggravating and making worse in every possible way? And she's just like, well, you know, we got, we are moving people around, but we got to stop moving people around. But we are going to keep moving them around. So, did you vote for this woman? Did anybody vote for this? Why? Why did you vote for this woman? She has been mayor for like 3 months, right? I mean, she hasn't been mayor that long. And funny, the same thing's happening with Mamdani, right? It's like, you freaking idiots. What did you think she was going to do? She's doing everything she ran on. She hates corporations. She's going to raise your taxes. She's going to give all the money to criminals and drug addicts. She's going to plant them in your neighborhood. And by the way, she's only going to fix things temporarily during the World Cup so that nobody knows how bad it is. And then it's going to get even worse as soon as everybody goes home. She's following the Gavin Newsom, we have guest visiting model. Why did you vote for this? What did you think she was going to do? These people are like, we voted you for you, we campaigned for you, and now you've turned your back on us. What did you think she was doing? What did you think she was going to do? She said she would do all of this. You're getting exactly what you voted for. Why do you keep voting for it? For the love of God, people. Let's finish the clip here.
Obviously, because you brought that sound to us, and there were some tough questions that Mayor Wilson had to field. I will give her credit for coming to the event. She tried to answer as many questions as possible. Was willing to stay late.
Let's pause it right there, too. Again, this is the friendly media. This is the left-wing media. And they're basically like, I'm just proud of her for showing up and doing her best. Really? Because she's the mayor of a major American city. I think we should expect a little bit more than existence. I think mere presence, you know, receiving questions, but being incapable of answering any of them is not exactly the victory that you would expect. Like, again, who does this? Who behaves this way? Even if you were on her side, like, this is your city. This is your life. It's like the tough questions to answer were people being like, I don't want to pay more taxes. I don't know if I'm going to make it home safe tonight. We've had 25 employees who have had to make use of their rape whistles walking home. I don't know how many employees that woman has. 25 is a lot for any company. Most companies have about one or two employees. I'm going to guess that, you know, that's like 75% of her entire workforce has had at one point or another to use a loud noise to try to avoid being the victim of a crime in Seattle. These are not difficult questions to handle. They're only difficult to handle if the things that are happening are your fault and your priorities and your
ideology has no ability to contend with these things. So she's now getting praised. She is now, the mayor of Seattle is now being praised by the Fox News anchor for showing up and totally bombing every question, having no good answers. It doesn't matter because at least she was there. At least she showed up. What are you talking about? Why would you run cover for somebody like this? This is your city. These are the streets where your children will be raised. These are your homes being made less safe. Your streets being destroyed. Why would you give cover to the person doing it when you know they're doing it? What? Let's finish up. This is just crazy. Let's keep watching.
May have not been the kind of the concrete answers that many people were looking for.
Definitely not. As you heard, it left many people wanting more direct answers, specifically to some of the key topics, 12th and Jackson, stabbing shootings there, and the power washing that people said. Mayor Wilson alluded to a plan that is coming sometime very soon, and that's pretty much all she said. When we talk about KCRHA and the management of everything that she's doing to curb the crisis, she says that, are we dismantling it, specifically when you asked her? And she said, stay tuned.
Yeah, KCRHA, the King County Regional Homelessness yes. Authority that's tasked with, you know, clearing up homelessness in our region. She said she's going to have maybe a yes or no answer on that very soon. And lastly, there was something else. Aurora Avenue came up a couple of times
because they're
dealing with a lot of crime there. What did she say? Because she did allude that some things are coming down the pipeline there.
Yes, yeah, so specifically she said we're taking immediate actions right now. She said that there's emphasis patrols in this area. That she's doing a lot of work, specifically working with SDOT to try and get a quick study done. But a lot of people were wondering, when is this quick study? When are you getting those results?
What are you studying? Okay, wait, we can take it down. It's the same thing over and over. I mean, literally. Again, I don't know. I don't know how people watch that and don't, like, move out of Seattle. Like, what are you talking about? Because they're doing their best. They're trying to spin it. They're trying to act like, hey, you know, she's doing her best with a tough situation. She can't answer a single question. And the only response she has is to vaguely allude to future plans that do not exist. Future projects that will definitely fix everything. We just got to get this study done first. Well, tell you what, dumbass. You legalized hard drugs. You legalized prostitution. The pimps and drug dealers showed up in the neighborhood immediately after, and everything got less safe. What is your study going to show you exactly? The obvious and observable fact? The consequence follows the cause? Like, what? This is your city under leftism. They will literally pass a law that's just like, pimps get to shoot up your neighborhood. And then when you're like, we don't like pimps shooting up our neighborhood, they go, don't worry, we'll spend the next couple months doing a study to figure out why pimps are shooting up your neighborhood, and we'll get back to you. In the meantime, it's illegal to put up barriers. In the meantime, we will be sending city crews to go knock down the safety barricades that you established yourself, because you have to, because there's nothing as ubiquitous in a leftist system as regular citizens having to spend their own blood, sweat, and tears to make up for what their government has taxed them to death to achieve. Let's go to this video. This is clip 38. We'll watch the first minute or so of this, because this is what's happening on the street of Seattle as the mayor is being congratulated and you know, thanked for merely showing up and being incapable of answering a single question about anything her government is doing or anything positive happening for the city or even whether she likes Starbucks or not. She has no idea. She can't answer. She's an idiot. Who's incompetent, and you voted for, you absolute morons. Here's what you get.
Today, the Aurora community is fighting back against the pimp wars and open-air sex trafficking, demanding the city of Seattle finally take action.
They're holding a sign, stop sex trafficking, no more shooting.
I'm pretty mad right now, so I'm just going to get through this. So they say Aurora has always been like this. Not like this. The city should have known living this close to Aurora. I like this. They say it's the oldest profession in the world. Just legalize it and it will go away. Not like this. They say to the police to leave the girls alone. Otherwise, you're going to further traumatize them. I'm not leaving them like this. Before, we didn't have pimps following us home and pointing guns at our houses.
Yeah, we're going to have to do a study to, like, find out what's happening here. We're going to try to expedite that study to see if we can't figure out what drugs we need to be supplying. You know, if there was maybe a safe brothel that these women could be using, maybe that would solve this problem. Maybe we can pass more gun control. That might be a solution. They cause the problem, and then they act like retards when it comes time to solve it. Seattle neighborhood declares war against pimps shooting up Aurora Avenue while engaging in turf wars over prostitutes. Residents say they've been constantly dodging bullets since the city decriminalized prostitution in 2020, resulting in open-air sex trafficking and an increase in gun violence. If the city refuses to address the years-long issue, some residents want President Trump to intervene and order a federal crackdown. Ah, yes. And the two sides work in perfect harmony and perfect symbiosis to cause the problems that necessitate federal intervention and a destruction of our rights. Everything's going to plan, folks. Thanks for being here with us. We'll see you again soon.